PD, right?
Yes, not for us.
Not for general, right.
Yeah. When I...
Have you met Connie and Anthony or Ted?
Hi, nice to meet you. Anthony from Walton Heights.
So, on the 22nd, they become official board members?
Okay.
All right, now we can call this meeting to order. All those that are on the board are present, so, wow. And I bet you gave me an agenda in the summer. There we go. Let's jump right into Longworth since they're out there.
Okay. So I'll just remind the board that you have a 12.5% target to real estate. You're currently at 11.5, so we need to allocate a little bit more money there. You already have money with the SCAR, so they're going to do a review of what you currently have with them and then tell you about their new product for a possible investment.
This is Longworth?
Yes.
And this has all worked out well since they moved away from Fidelity?
Yes. And they've done very well for you.
Good morning.
So about 30 minutes. Formal presentation, maybe a couple minutes for questions, okay?
Sure. We're pretty practiced at this, so we can do this. Rose has seen this a couple times. We can certainly do this in less than 30 minutes, but happy to answer much details about it.
Do the background music or...
So I want to start by saying thanks for having us down, not just to be able to update you on the existing fund and talk a little bit about the new fund, but also if you look out the window here, it's beautiful here. We've got a pretty good blizzard hitting us in Boston right now, so thanks for the excuse to get us out of town there.
Excuse me, let me just start off with one thing which I frequently have to do, and it's your confidentiality notification on this. These are public records and they're subject to disclosure upon request.
Yes, yep. Thank you for that. And we are used to that with a number of our public pension fund clients, so yes. Thanks for that. So per Rose's instructions, we thought we'd give you a quick update on the team. So it's been actually many years since we came in to visit you. I think I was here in late 2008, and that was the last time I think we came down to give an update to Ocala. So we'll give you an update on the team. We'll obviously give you an update on the existing fund, Fund 3, and then we'll talk a little bit about what we're doing with the new fund. And so over the course of that, obviously, we can talk about strategy and process and what we're seeing in the market. So whatever's of most interest, and you direct us however is most useful for you. So the first couple pages here give you a quick update on the team. Page 3 is a color-coded roadmap here. So you may recall when the city hired us back in 2008 in Fund 3, our team was inside of Fidelity Investments at the time. So our team was part of Fidelity from 95 really through the end of 2008, and I was with the team from the beginning. So I joined Fidelity in early 1995 when we were putting the team together. So our team began the process of spinning out at the end of 2008, shortly after we finished raising capital for Fund 3. We then essentially became Longworth in early 2009, finished investing Fund 3 through the end of 2011, early 2012. So there was a good bit of the fund that still was yet to be invested when we became Longworth. We finished investing Fund 3. We then raised our first fund, Fund 4, as Longworth a couple years ago. That fund's been fully invested, and now we're raising capital and investing our new fund, Fund 5. So it's called Longworth Real Estate Partners 5. But it's really the same team that's been together over the course of 20-plus years. Obviously, some changes along the way. The team has evolved, the process has evolved, but it's really many members of the same team that have been with us for close to 20 years. On the next page, you need to see some bullet points, and I'll just highlight a couple things. So one, our management company is 100% partner-owned. When we spun out of Fidelity, we did it on terms very favorable to us that allowed us to form Long Wharf without bringing in any outside capital partners. So we started with a very clean economic slate. The other thing is that because we had the existing fund with us and in-place fee revenues, we invested very heavily in our infrastructure. So believe it or not, and we've been saying this to our clients, have known this for years, our infrastructure for what we do is far better as Long Wharf than anything we had at Fidelity, because Fidelity really didn't do anything in private real estate. When you think of Fidelity, you think of mutual funds. So the infrastructure and the systems that we have in place at Long Wharf that we put in place over the past 6 to 7 years are terrific for what we do. And all we do, again, are these U.S. value-added real estate funds, one fund at a time. So I always think that we are an interesting and hopefully attractive combination of attributes, where we are this focused investment boutique doing one thing. At the same time, we have the institutional DNA of being inside of Fidelity for many years before we became Long Wharf. So, of course, happy to answer any questions about our company if they come up along the way here. Page 5 is our team. So 21 people, again, focused just on U.S. value-added real estate. About two-thirds of the people you see on this page were with us at Fidelity, and about a third have joined us over the past 6 to 7 years. We feel that's a good mix of stability and experience, and also adding some very smart, young, talented people to the team. So very well resourced considering what our strategy is. And then finally on page 6, it's just a snapshot of who our investors are. And over the series of funds here, you can see that public pension funds are the single most important part of our capital base, and I think that number will only go up going forward here. So we have a diverse set of institutional clients, but none more important to us than public pension funds.
Okay. So we can flip ahead to page 8, and I'll give you a quick update on Fidelity Real Estate Growth Fund 3, which you are invested in. We finished investing this fund, finished raising this fund in 2008. And you can see in the chart on the left on the bottom when we put it to work. We put the first portion of the fund to work in 2007 and 2008. And then obviously there was a pause in investments during the GFC. And then put the rest of the fund to work in 2010 through 2012. We've made 33 investments, called over $782 million of capital. And so far have distributed $890 million of proceeds to date. We're showing those distributions, the actuals and distributions on the right side, and the projected distributions for 2016 in the teal. Okay. On 9, we're showing you the progress towards realization. So you can see listed here the names of every deal that we've done in Fund 3. In the left bar here in the blue are all the investments that have now been fully realized. And then we're breaking up the remaining investments, which is 6 investments, into what we think will be the near-term realizations, as well as the other realizations, all of which we think will take place during 2016. So we're really on track to sell all 6 of the remaining investments this year. And you can see what we're projecting for the proceeds there. And then finally, for Fund 3, on page 10, we're giving you an update on your specific investment. So you can see your $2.1 million of contributed capital. To date, we've distributed $2.4 million, and the current NAV of the remaining portion of that. We're showing our returns here over a 1-year, 3-year, 5-year, and since inception basis. Currently about an 8% annualized IRR, which is tracking very well for a 2007 vintage fund. And then we're showing what we think we'll distribute back to you this year after we sell the remaining investments. So somewhere between $425,000 and $450,000 of distributions coming back to you.
Okay. Okay, so we thought we'd just give you a quick look at a couple of the investments in Fund 3. One that we've sold recently, and one investment that's in the current portfolio, Sarah mentioned, that we expect to sell this year. Would that be helpful? We just did a quick overview of these two investments, just give you a feel for what our strategy was in Fund 3. So page 12, and both of these are examples of assets that we bought coming out of the downturn where clearly you had a substantial repricing of real estate properties. Typically capital structures were broken in many of these assets, and either the debt had formally taken over ownership of the asset or was about to. And so on page 12, here's an example of one where the lender had actually foreclosed on the asset. So this is a retail center in the Dallas market, and this was one where both the capital structure was broken and actually physically it was broken as well. It's a little difficult to tell from this small picture up top, but it was an outdoor lifestyle center, very well located right in one of the major thoroughfares in Dallas. And really what you had was you had the center of the shopping center doing very well. Those stores performed well, but what they needed was an anchor on the north portion of the site and an anchor on the south portion of the site. So we purchased this asset from the lender who had foreclosed on it. You can see the Whole Foods logo right there. We put in a large 45,000 square foot Whole Foods to anchor the northern part of the site. This picture is actually looking towards the south, so that Whole Foods is on the northern portion of the site. And then at the top of the picture, which is the southern portion, we put in a large theater, some restaurants, and a big parking deck you can see. And with that, you continue to stabilize the portion of the center that was working well, and then everything else, the new additions have performed very well also. So when we bought it, it was about half vacant. We did this work to it, we leased it up, essentially fully occupied. And with many things that we do, so we took an asset that was broken, we fixed it, we turned it into an income-producing core asset, and then when we put this on the market last year, as we had hoped for, there was a bit of a feeding frenzy from the various core funds that were interested in an asset like this, and we ended up selling this to one of the largest core funds out there managed by UBS, who ended up paying us substantially more for the asset than what we thought we would get. And so this is certainly an example of a property that performed well for us. So we had expected going in to generate a nice return. You can see about a 17% IRR and what we call an equity multiple. So for every dollar we put in, getting $1.90 back. And we ended up outperforming that substantially. So you can see we sold this in the middle of last year, 2015. And the IRR was substantially higher, and the equity multiple was substantially higher. And again, it's because if you can take these broken assets and fix them and sell them into the core market right now, there is a great deal of interest in properties like this. And so that's something that we continue to do. And here's an example on page 13. So this is one of the six investments still left in the fund. Similar story, this was an office property in Southern California. So this is in Riverside, which is about an hour east of Los Angeles. This was a newly built office building that had trouble leasing. The loan on it was from B of A, and so the developer got into trouble. We ended up buying this in a short sale. So the seller negotiated with B of A for a short sale. So we purchased this, again, at a very low basis. It wasn't that going in, we thought that the Riverside market was going to be terrific and the fundamentals were strong and we could lease it up easily. It was more that if we bought it as cheap as we did, so you can see we bought it at about $90 a foot, versus what it had just been built for, which was over $200 a foot, at that cost basis, we felt like we could lease up in a difficult market against any of the buildings that we were competing against in the submarket. We gave ourselves several years to do it, which we've now done. So this building is now, you can see, 95% occupied, which is stabilized. And we are about to list this right now for sale. And this also will generate a good bit of interest upon sale because it's a well-leased, high-quality, newly-built office building that's now got a stabilized rent roll. So this should have a very liquid market when we begin the formal process shortly here. So that's just two examples. We actually, in Fund 3, we invested in many different property types. A lot of what we did coming out of the downturn was similar to that, in that we bought good-quality assets at what we felt was a very low basis. Where essentially what we were doing is taking leasing risk. So again, our thought was, even in a difficult economic environment, which it was, if we bought at the right basis, we could compete effectively, and we were able to do that. So just about all the leasing work in Fund 3 is behind us, and as Sarah mentioned, most of the assets, if you remember that bar on the left, most of the assets have been sold, and we're now selling the remaining properties.
Okay. So flipping ahead to page 15, we've got some quick highlights on Fund 5, which is the fund that we're currently raising. We're targeting a fund size of $350 million. We've deliberately picked this fund size, which is smaller than Fund 3. If you remember, Fund 3 was a larger fund. It took us 5 to 6 years to put to work, and we're really looking to raise a fund size that we can invest in 2 to 3 years. So targeting 350, to date, we've raised $240 million, and we've actually already put almost $100 million of that to work in 5 investments that have closed and have a number that we expect to close over the upcoming months. So we really like this fund size. It's what we think is a good moderate fund size. We don't have to change our investment size or our investment pace. It really matches what our team is doing right now. The fund is targeting a 12 to 15% net IRR invested in U.S. value-add properties. Okay. And now we've got a little bit more information about our investment approach, as well as a couple of the investments that we've already done in Fund 5 that we're raising.
Yeah, so you two have got several pages on philosophy and strategy and process. We won't go into too much detail on these pages, again, unless you direct us to. Front of page 17, I think a couple of things that I would focus on, and one ties very closely into what Sarah just said. So first of all, a value-oriented approach. I mentioned before that we're very focused on basis. So what is not just the purchase price of the asset, but more important than that, once we finish doing whatever we need to do to the asset, what's our all-in cost basis? And the reason why we're focused on that so much is that the single most important metric we look at when underwriting a new investment is what is the stabilized yield on cost. So if there's anything Sarah and I can convey to you today, it's that that's the most important metric for us. And what that means is when we are done doing whatever we're doing to the asset, so sometimes there's some physical work like the asset in Dallas you mentioned, but in general, it's some sort of leasing work we're doing to these assets. Sometimes it's a lot of leasing, other times it's a little bit less. But when we're done stabilizing the asset, and typically it's year 4, somewhere between year 3 to year 5, what is the annual net operating income that the asset is generating divided by our total cost basis? And it's forget leverage, so take away, we look at an unlevered yield on cost. That's the metric that's important to us. And if we feel like we can generate a yield on cost that is substantially higher, not just to what today's current yields are, but assuming that yields go up, so when you go to sell it, the yields will be higher, which is a less favorable sales market than what we have today. We want to make sure that we have a substantial cushion of where we're stabilizing these assets compared to where we expect to sell them down the road. So that's the most important thing we look at, which is why basis is so important to us. The other thing I'll mention on this page is, Sarah mentioned the fund size. Part of the reason why we want to do more moderate size funds is we typically target what we call middle market assets, which are assets that have a gross value of between, call it 30 to 70 million. So that's all in gross value. And that means an equity investment from the fund typically is somewhere between 10 to 20 million. And so those are smaller assets in general than what some of the other big funds do. That's what we've been doing for 20 years. I think that's the bread and butter of what we do. I think that's what we'll continue to do. And when you're doing investments of that size, it's easier for us to have these smaller funds because we're doing a large number of transactions in these funds. We want to have a diversified portfolio. Fund 5, we expect to have somewhere between 25 to 35 different investments. And again, we want to be able to invest it over the course of 2 to 3 years, which I think works much better for our clients because it helps them with planning and knowing when their money's going to be put to work. And it's better for us as well. So we would rather raise these moderate-sized funds, not have the weight of capital on us, so not have the burden of having to put money to work, be very selective about what we're doing, and invest the fund in a time frame that works for our investors.
What is your sort of target to various different parts of the market, office, multifamily, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so Rose, we don't have going in targets. So sometimes core funds, the big core funds will say, okay, we've got a target of 35% to office and 30% to multifamily and X percent to retail, and they go in and they have to buy assets to meet those target allocations. We do it the opposite way, which is we want to find the best opportunities we can find, but then we have concentration ceilings to make sure that we don't put the entire fund in a single sector or a single market. So we don't have going in target allocations, but in a long answer to your question, Rose, I would expect us to have exposure to all of the major property types. So you'll see us invested in office and retail and industrial and multifamily, probably a little bit in hotel as well. If we had to guess, I think we'll end up probably about, I would say 40%, give or take, in office. and then a little bit less in multifamily and retail, and probably a little bit less than that in industrial, and then less than that in hotel, and I'd be too surprised if we did much in property types outside of those sectors. I think that's the key.
Is that typically the mix that you wind up with in these partnerships?
It's been the mix over the past 5 years, and right now there's not a lot coming at us that would suggest that we're going to do it dramatically different than that. So the one sector that's interesting is the apartment sector, which got very expensive very quickly coming out of the downturn. It's happened here, it certainly happened in Florida, it's happened elsewhere, where yields on apartment properties got very, very low very quickly. That scared us a little bit, because what that means is, in order to do what we want to do and hit that stabilized yield on cost, you need to assume very aggressive rent projections. And we weren't comfortable doing that. So we have done probably a little bit less in the apartment sector than I think we will do in this fund, because I think we're starting to see a few cracks now. So we're starting to see areas of weakness in pricing in apartments in certain markets, which is that's the one sector that, whereas if you look back over the past 5 years, we've probably done maybe 10 to 15% in apartments. Maybe we do a little bit more in the new fund. Maybe it's more like 15 to 25%. Other than that, though, generally the ranges that I mentioned are pretty typical of what we've been doing.
Obviously, that's a geographic diversification, too.
Yeah. We are diversified. So there's some funds out there that will target either a specific property type or a specific market. And we're not one of them. We want to be able to turn over as many rocks as possible in as many different markets and property types as possible. So we're typically biased towards the bigger markets. So you've got the primary market. So we're investors in New York and Washington and Chicago and Los Angeles and San Francisco. So we're clearly active in markets like that. But we will also invest going down into markets, say Dallas and Houston and Atlanta, some of those markets as well. So we are diversified. Over the 20 plus years, we've actually invested quite a bit in Florida. It will come and go. Florida's gotten expensive, so we are looking in Florida quite a bit, but again, we're trying to find cracks a little bit, if you will, because Florida, many of the markets in Florida have gotten expensive, yields have gotten low, so this is a market we'd like to do a little bit more in, but we're just being very selective. But the fund will be diversified.
How do you identify properties that you might look at for purchase?
Yeah. So a couple of things. One, our team's been together a long time, so we've got what we call is a network of relationships in many markets. So I will start by saying that any market that we invest in the new fund, we've invested in before. So we've invested in, I can't think of a market in the U.S. that we've not invested in before. So we've been active in these markets before. But most important is that just about everything we do with a local operating partner. So we typically structure our investments as, call it 90-10, where we put in 90% of the equity, 90-10 joint ventures with local operating partners in these markets. And these are relationships that, again, we've built and nurtured over the course of 20 plus years. And they are critical to finding these opportunities for us. So sometimes we'll find them directly and then we'll bring in a local operating partner. But more often than not, it's the local operating partner that's been working on a transaction on a property for years, trying to pry it loose, and then they'll call us and say, okay, we think we're getting close to getting this tied up, come down and look at it with us, and that's when we'll get involved and we'll heavily underwrite it, and again, we'll put together that equity joint venture that I mentioned before, which we're putting in the vast majority of the money. We have control over the entire process, but they're critical to finding those opportunities for us.
What is the skill set normally that you find in these partners that you joint venture with?
Yeah, so it varies depending on the market and the property type. Sometimes these groups have heavy, I'll say development expertise. Not that we're doing a lot of development, but they're just, a lot of these people are developers by background, and so they've just got heavy hands-on real estate expertise. And so whether the property needs a lot of physical work or not, that's a skill set that we look for in these operating partners. Oftentimes they have heavy leasing experience. So it's typically a combination of hands-on physical development work and or leasing work. So that's, I think, the biggest skill set. But in each of these situations, so we'll have these operating partners, and then we will fill in around them with whatever additional resources on an investment we need. So just because, let's say, the operating partner that we work with has a lot of leasing experience, and people on our team have a lot of leasing experience as well, but we'll go ahead and then bring in other leasing groups as well to help us with that asset. So bottom line is, it's hands-on real estate experience, oftentimes development, including construction and leasing, but these are folks that are on the ground, oftentimes specializing in a certain property type. So not only do they specialize in a market, but they specialize in office or retail or industrial, and they've got hands-on experience that will then supplement with people on our team and other local firms as well. So we'll bring in third-party property management firms and leasing firms to supplement what our operating partner doesn't have. But they are our eyes and ears on the ground with the asset.
So in order to get the occupancy you get to, do you go below market rates in order to fill in all these rentals? I mean, superficially, you understand what I'm asking. You go a little bit below to entice the people to get the occupancy, but...
Absolutely, and that's exactly what we did coming out of the downturn with these assets. That's exactly what we did. So we went in, and we do this now. So we'll go in and we'll say, okay, here's our all-in basis with this property. And then what we want to know is, what's the ownership basis of all the assets that we're competing against, right? So if we're going in, and let's say we're all in at $150 a foot, whatever property might be, we want to know, okay, so this property, they're in at 180, they're in at 250, they're in at 280. So we'll know exactly where we can offer rents and TI packages, tenant improvement packages. So it's not just rents, it's the overall package. And we know where we can compete against the properties around us. We know exactly where market rents are, right? So we can see where every lease has been signed over the past couple years. And coming out of the downturn, one of the things we did is we said, we're going to go in. So market rents are here, right? So maybe rents 5 years ago were here. Now market rents are here, and we're going to go in and we're going to offer rents here. So that's exactly what we did. We'd go in and undercut the market. That's what we did, for example, with the two assets that I showed you in Fund 3. In certain occasions, we can do that right now. So typically when we go in, especially what we're doing right now, we want to go in with the ability to do that. We want to go in and know that we can undercut the market and still achieve an attractive yield on cost and an attractive overall return. In certain situations, or in many situations, it turns out that you don't need to do it, right? You can go in, and if you got the right building, you can lease up at market. The second part of it is, though, is that, so it's not just, so let's say we're leasing up at market, we want to make sure when we're looking at these assets that we're not counting on market rent growth to get to our numbers. Right. So let's say market, we're buying an asset in the new fund, and we're saying going in right now, in-place rents, let's say, are 15 net, market is 18 net, but to get to our numbers, we need that market rent growth to go from 18 to 22 over the course of the hold period. We don't want to have to do that. We want to go in and say, okay, we're going to rent at market, we're going to rent at $18, but we don't need market rent growth from here. We never want to count on that to get to our numbers. So that's a great question. Especially in this market where you've got a little bit of uncertainty right now, a little bit of caution creeping in, we want to make sure that to get to that yield on cost and that total return, we don't need substantial market rent growth.
So do you lock these people in with longer term leases, or?
Totally depends on the asset. So we've got assets right now where we're doing, you know, certain office buildings, certain markets, we've got long-term leases. In other situations, especially, you know, an industrial building is a good example. And, you know, a lot of our industrial buildings leases are more sort of 4 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. Whereas, in the new fund, we just purchased an office building in Dallas where we've got, there's two key tenants in the office building. They both roll in a couple years. So their leases expire in a couple years. One is AllianceBernstein. And we're right now negotiating. This is part of our strategy. So AllianceBernstein, their lease rules in 2019, we want to stabilize them in the building. So we're now negotiating a 10-year extension of AllianceBernstein to 2029.
Right.
So if we can buy this building, well, we bought the building, if we can agree to this extension with AllianceBernstein through 2029, there's one other key tenant as well that we're in the process of doing a long-term extension, we could go ahead and sell that building tomorrow. Because you've essentially locked up the rent roll there, and you've got long-term leases, very high quality credit tenants. So in that type of property, you've got long-term leases. In other properties, they can be shorter.
What about development? I saw you have a sort of cap on possible development within the property. I don't know if you've done that in the past. Do you sort of foresee any of that in this fund?
Yeah, so we've done quite a bit of development over the years, much less over the past 5 years, because you don't need to do it. So if you can buy existing assets below replacement cost, substantially below replacement cost, which is what we've been doing, you don't need to do development. I would anticipate us to very, very selectively do some development. So in Fund 4, in which Ocala, so that's the fund after the fund in which Ocala invested, Fund 4, we ended up just under 20% in development, so the vast majority is in existing assets. I think the new fund will end up looking just like that as well. So I think the new fund, I would expect, will end up somewhere around 20% or so. So very selectively, we will look at opportunities. There's one opportunity we're looking at in the new fund right now, which is a hotel development in Atlanta, very similar to a transaction we did in Fund 3, which was extraordinarily successful. And what made it so successful was we had the local municipality. So this was where the airport is in Atlanta, so the town is actually College Park, which is where Hartsfield is. College Park gave us 30% of the build cost in public funds that did not need to be reimbursed because they wanted this hotel built. So we were able to build it, stabilize it, and sell it for less than what it cost us to build it and still earn our return. And we did that. So we sold it last year. It did extremely well. With our same operating partner in Atlanta in the new fund, we're going to do something similar. This is up in Alpharetta, where Alpharetta is giving us 25% of the total construction cost of this hotel because they want it built so badly. So we're going to build it and then sell it for less than what it cost us to build it down the road and still get to our returns. So that's the type of opportunity. Very selectively, we'll do some things like that. We want to make sure we've got a very experienced partner. We want to make sure the economic case is compelling. And in that situation where, again, you can sell it below replacement cost, we're attracted to opportunities like that.
Leverage. How do you normally approach properties from the leverage standpoint, and how did you all fare during the 2000, what year was it that everything went to hell?
Yeah. So a couple thoughts here. So our group, like other groups, clearly learned some lessons during that downturn. So anybody who's doing what we did learned lessons of one way or another. I think one thing we did extremely well, which is what we still do, is that any leverage we have, we will not take recourse. We will not take repayment guarantees. We do not want the fund guaranteeing debt. So that if something does go terribly wrong with an investment, with an asset, we don't want any exposure to hit other assets in the fund. So that is something that we've always done and will continue to do. That being said, I think where you become especially vulnerable in debt is on the development side. And so because typically, when you're going in, if you're doing a development project, now not the one that we're going to do in Fund 5, I'll explain that in a second, but let's say if you're doing an office construction or an apartment construction, typically you'll have 3-year debt on it that'll come due, and then you'll have some sort of an extension option, but there's all sorts of variables that come into play with the extension option. So we faced some tough decisions in the downturn, like other groups did, where you had this loan termination coming at you and you have to decide whether to defend the asset or not. So you end up with, I think, a very binary situation in that where you have to decide, should we put good money after bad or should we walk away from this asset? That every group out there faces decisions like that. So if you look at what we do now, first of all, typically we're using less leverage than we did 10 years ago. So we've lowered the leverage ceiling in our fund. Whereas 10 years ago, I think the average leverage across most of what we're doing was close to 70%. Right now in Fund 4 and the new fund, Fund 5, we're typically mid-50s to low 60s. So we've got 10 to 15 percentage points less debt than what we had 10 years ago. The other thing we're doing, we're doing less development, so we've got less construction debt with those terminations staring at you. And then finally, in a lot of what we're doing right now, we're putting on a little bit longer term debt. So we're using less leverage. And especially if we have a more stabilized asset that's got some more cash flow, we're putting on 4 to 6 year debt right now with very easy extension options. So a lot of what we're doing right now, let's say you've got 5-year debt and you've got 2 1-year extensions options after that have very manageable covenants to hit, keeping in mind that our typical hold period for these assets is 3 to 4 years. So we're giving ourselves multiple years of cushion beyond our hold period because we've been doing this long enough to know that not every asset goes according to plan. So I think that was a long way of saying that we are, I think, more conservative with our leverage than we used to be, as most groups are. So we're using less leverage. We use almost entirely bank debt because it's much easier to negotiate with banks than it is with securitized debt. And we want to make sure that we're very mindful of what our extension options are, to have flexibility to be able to extend the term of the debt without having to put more money into the asset. Should we keep going here?
I see the principals are putting in about 7% of this fund.
No, I think it'd be less than that, right? Because we're putting in $5 million.
Right. I was thinking $350 million, but...
Right, so $5 million of $350 million, right, which is going to be a little bit less than that. It's going to be, but I will say, if you compare to what we're doing at Fidelity, where Fidelity would make a general partner commitment, never that big, but the principles of the group, we have five times the amount of our personal money in this fund than we did at the fund that you invested in Fund 3. So the principals invested $1 million in Fund 3. We're investing $5 million in this fund, in the fund, as a partner in the fund, just like our other investors. We pay the same management fees, the same expenses. We're in every single investment. Every time our investors get a capital call, we get a capital call and write a check into the fund. And so we've got a very meaningful amount of our personal money in this fund. We did it in Fund 4 as well. We're doing it in Fund 5. Very meaningful. And if you think, and I'm sort of skipping ahead a little bit, but if you think about how we structure these funds, and I think this is critical, the fee structure on this, you've got a base management fee, okay, which really just keeps the lights on, pays our salaries. Nobody makes money off the management fee in this fund. We've got the management fee, and then we have a performance fee, and that's it. So we have no other way to derive revenue from this fund other than hitting our performance rate. So any other potential revenue this fund could generate, it doesn't generate a lot of revenue, but to the extent there was any sort of transaction fees or some way for the fund to generate revenue, it goes to the fund and to the investors, not to us. So a lot of funds out there, every time they make an investment, they'll charge an acquisition fee. Or if they structure a loan on a property, they'll earn a capital markets fee. Or maybe they have property management affiliates out there either managing or leasing an asset, and they'll get leasing override fees. None of that. All in the documents, we can't earn anything. We get our base management fee and then our performance fee, and the only way we earn our performance fee is if our investors, they put their money in, they get all their money back, this is cash, it's not based on market values, and they have to earn a 9% annualized return net of all management fees and expenses, cash return to them, before we can earn our performance fee. And so that's it. And so I went into that because not only do we have a lot of our own personal money invested in this fund, but again, there's no way for us to create any sort of wealth off of this fund other than by hitting our performance objectives, which is very different than some other funds.
I think we have about 2 minutes.
Okay.
So if you
want to
wrap up.
So the pages on strategy and process in here, I think, one, we've sort of touched on them, but two, I think they're self-evident. It's probably just a little bit of us bragging about how great we think we are. Why don't we skip to page? Let's just hit on 22 real quick. We'll take a minute if that's okay, because this is just an example of where we've got. As Sarah mentioned, we've already put to work almost $100 million in the new fund. We've closed 5 investments. We've got a couple more that will close over the next few months here. This is an example because we talked about apartments and how apartments have gotten expensive, and for us to buy something, there's got to be something unique about it. This is unique. This is in the Chicago market. This was an apartment property that was built about 35 years ago when they built it. It's a sizable property. You can see it's about 550 units. They sold it off in pods, ownership pods of 6 units each. So there were 93 different condo interests, which each had 6 apartment units. It's an interesting way for them to sell this off. So that's the way it's been known ever since it was built. So with our partner, we came across this property. It's in a suburb called Westmont, which is a very, very strong suburb outside of Chicago. very high-end demographic, school system, everything you look for. But this property was completely broken in every way you can think about it. It had a broken ownership structure. It was broken physically. Sarah and I were just there last week. It's an eyesore for this community, for sure. But with our partner, we approached all 93 owners, put them under contract one by one, so that what we did now, we just closed on this a couple months ago, we're going to take this mess of an ownership structure and collapse it into one apartment property. So one single ownership structure that will have 550 units. So a conventional apartment property. We just closed a couple weeks ago on the 93rd unit, so we now own all 93. We are in the process of collapsing the homeowners association. We're also in the process of replatting it as one apartment property as opposed to all these different disparate interests. We'll do some physical work to it, not a ton, but we'll take it from, you know, sort of a crummy property, apartment property to a good apartment property. This is never going to be a Class A property. But just what we've done already in the ownership structure, we think we've already created most of the value that we ultimately expect to get. Just by collapsing it and turning it into a conventional ownership structure, we could probably sell this tomorrow and earn most of our return. We are going to go through, we're going to put some work into it, we're going to clean up the exteriors, we're going to do some work to the interiors. It'll be interesting to see, once we're done with that, let's say a year from now, whether we hold it in cash flow, because we think we're going to generate a very, very attractive yield. I wouldn't be surprised if we end up selling this pretty quickly, because people are going to approach us and say, we want to buy this. But if I can, I think we have it in here. Yeah, it's in the key assumptions. This is probably the most important thing. If you look at a stabilized yield on cost, we're going to stabilize this north of a 9% unlevered yield on cost. To do that in the apartment market right now is unheard of. If this, we could sell this property next week, probably between a 6 and a 6.5 yield. So we want to build up the rent a little bit, because we're going to see some rent growth accelerate once we do the work to it. But we could sell this tomorrow for a 6 to 6.5, and we expect to stabilize this 300 basis points north of that. And that big of a spread between our stabilized yield and our exit yield is how we'll get to the bulk of our return. So this is an example of an apartment property that we will buy, as opposed to just going out and bidding on these really nice newly built apartment properties that everybody wants right now, and you have to pay up for it, and you're buying really low yields, and you got to assume job growth and rent growth, and we don't want to do that. So that's just one example. So we've closed on 5 investments in the new fund. We're obviously excited about each of them. Naturally, we're doing them. And I think we touched on the fees a little bit. And in the conclusion page, we really just say that we hope to have the opportunity to keep working for you. So it's been, I think, close to 10 years now that we've been working for you, and hopefully we'll have the opportunity to continue with the new fund.
So we really don't have to do much, right?
Just vote on giving them money.
Just write a check.
We've already allocated for them, right?
Not for the new fund.
Not for the new fund.
Right, but they've given you all your money back for the old fund, so you can basically recycle that money, and we can talk about a number once they go of what we think.
And yeah, as in terms of the remaining fundraise here, so we've got our next closing will be probably sometime around late March. We have a number of public funds coming into that closing, and then we'll probably have one or two more in the second quarter. We expect to wrap up the fundraise here around probably late second quarter. Because again, as Sarah mentioned, we don't want to raise too much money. We want to keep a moderate size, and then a couple of years we'll raise our next one.
And because you already have a contract with them, you know, shouldn't be any contract issues.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thanks for all your questions, too.
Yeah, appreciate that.
We'd like to give the impression that we're informed.
Honestly, I think two of the key questions were the market rent and the leverage. I mean, right now, that's sort of the key, it's two of the key questions. So we're very mindful of both. And thank you also for taking us out of the storm. Rose's colleagues up in Boston are not.
Yeah, but there's another one hitting right now, right? So you're gonna fly into it?
Yeah. We're sort of assuming our flight's canceled. But we'll see.
I just did a cruise, and there were 27 people who didn't make the cruise because they couldn't get out of the north.
Really?
Yeah.
It was funny. When we hit Aruba, people were coming on with their suitcases, and when we hit Cartagena, some more were coming on. There's a little break and then the fly out of the north.
Yeah, we didn't have much of a winter until a few weeks ago. Now we're thankful for it. Thanks for having us in.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So if you turn your big books that you have, the bigger ones that you have, if you turn to page 24, that'll just show you your allocation, the bigger one. If you turn to page 24. The other one, Arnie.
I was going to say, it's not...
I think it's in front of you there.
There's?
No. No.
No.
Right here.
Maybe she, you know...
The city of Ocala, the...
Alicia's got you messed up. She didn't give you one.
Oh, okay. I'm like, where is our bigger one? This one's bigger. It's heavier, too.
24.
Yeah, you got the right one.
You have to number these one, two.
Right, yeah.
So we, they currently have 417,000.
Yes, money left. You gave them 2.1. They gave you back 2.4. So they've given you back everything that you gave to them. If you look under the contributed column there, and then distributed. You commit a certain amount of money, but they don't always call all the money. Depends on the investments. So they took 2.1 from you. They've given you back 2.4. It's still worth 400,000. Your allocation, like I said, is your target's at, if you look on the left, your target's at 12.5%, and you're at 11.47. So you definitely have money to allocate to them. If you look at Penn Square, you'll be getting all that Penn Square money back, the 900,000. You'll be getting the 417,000 back. So that's going to even bring your allocation down lower. So we would recommend that you at least give them what you gave them before, the 2.4, or you might want to allocate 3 million to them, because your total fund is growing, and so that means you need a larger percentage.
And when are they going live? Well, they're already live, so it's, so by March, we have to have some money that they can start drawing on, right?
Yeah. And you're over allocated in a couple asset classes, like large cap and stuff like that. So we'll take that money from there, and then as you get money back from real estate, we just, allocate it as necessary.
So you know me, it's all about fees. So I see on a sheet you gave us, they hit us with 1%, but he was talking about performance.
And here it says 1.5% management fee.
Right.
Right.
So...
That's a very, average fee, if not on the low side for real estate.
Right.
And remember that all your returns that are in this book plus what they showed are net returns. So you're getting a very strong net return from them. But because it's a fund, it's not like... some funds I could go and try to negotiate your fees lower.
Yep.
This one, you couldn't really do that because it's a fund. Everybody has to have the same fees, so you can't really do much negotiation.
So we need a motion to...
invest in the new fund, Fund 5.
Are we talking dollars now as well?
Yeah.
Based upon our experience with them, I'd like to make a motion that we make our investment in this partnership 5, and that we go with a $3 million commitment.
I'm
good with that.
You'll second it, or you want me to second?
I'll second it.
Okay. Any discussion, or we're fine with it? Already had our discussion? So, we'll vote, three of us, aye?
Aye.
Unanimous, all three of us. Well, Rose, we got your big book open. You want to keep on going?
Yes, absolutely. So, I will just communicate that with them, and they'll get their contracts over to Lee, so we can get that going.
And we don't think that'd be a problem, since they're not going to change much, I guess. Right? Just a dollar amount on the...
Hopefully they didn't change much.
Well,
But usually, if they have a side letter that they agree to an earlier fund, they'll just agree to the same side letter for the next fund if there's any issues. So should not be a problem. The reason why I like for real estate for you to continue with the fund, unlike your equity managers, like a large cap manager that's managing money for you, unless they perform badly, you don't fire them. For a real estate manager, it has a finite life of 10 years. So if you don't re-up with the new fund, it's almost like you're firing them. So unless a real estate manager performed poorly for you, I'm not going to come in here and say, hey, don't look at their new fund. So that's why we didn't necessarily do a search for this. If somebody's done well for you, I want you to stay with that person and let them continue to do well for you. Especially, and we gave you this, which is our research group's, you know, seal on that, which is that they're a recommended manager by our group, and we like this fund. All right, I'll move on to performance. So this is under tab one. We like to talk about the markets a little bit. I think you do know that our research group has a call that you can be on that goes through the market conditions for each quarter. So under page one, the MSCI World, the fourth quarter, we had a little bit of a rally there coming off of, you know, three quarters of really bad markets in 2015. MSCI World, which includes U.S. and non-U.S. stocks, was up 5.5%. But still negative for the year-to-date period. And you can look at the 10-year period for the MSCI World and really a 5% return. So really been a tough market over the last couple of years for the MSCI World. The Russell 3000, which includes small cap, mid cap, and large cap stocks, was up 6% for the quarter. Basically flat year-to-date, a little bit positive. But you can see that 3-year and 5-year return still really strong coming off of 2008. You know, the markets in the U.S. had come out with strong returns. The MSCI EAFE, positive for the quarter. We had seen non-U.S. get beat up really, you know, tough in the market, but did have an okay quarter, still negative year to date. And then the emerging markets index, you know, did see a little bit of a positive for the quarter, not much. And then you can see negative from the year to date, the 3-year and the 5-year returns there. The Ag, which is the bond index, that's U.S. bonds, was negative for the quarter. You did see the Fed finally raise rates, and when rates are raised, you know, it's a negative for bonds. So you see bonds with a negative return for the quarter, basically flat for the year. They are at a little positive, 0.55%. And you can see the 10-year, which is basically our projections on bonds over time, you know, in the 4% range, and that's really what we expect going forward. The WGBI index, which is the non-U.S. bond index, down 1% for the quarter, down for the year, 5%. And that's really the currency effect. We've had a really strong dollar that has a huge effect on international bonds. Even though in their countries they've been doing well, the bonds have, when you translate them to U.S., you get the negative effect there. Commodities, and commodities have been affecting emerging markets, or emerging markets are affecting commodities. People like to talk about that. They both affect each other. Really negative for the period, and that affected PIMCO, your fund, and that's why we interviewed at the last meeting, or the meeting before, we interviewed a replacement for PIMCO because of that issue there, that PIMCO's returns were so negative. Real estate has been doing very well. You look at the real estate returns, that's really what helped people's portfolio. People who have private equity and real estate last year did well. The more real estate you did have, the better you performed. And it's like deals like they talked about, and that's why real estate's been doing well. People willing to go in there and do the work have been rewarded. And the hedge fund indices, hedge funds have basically been flat. If you look, they're a little bit between bonds and equities. That's what they sort of said they would do. Obviously, we like long-term for hedge funds to have stronger returns. We'll move on to page 6 to talk a little bit about the S&P 500. As many of you know, January was a great time for the S&P. February's been all over the place. So last I looked, we were down about 5%. After last week, we're probably down even more than that with the S&P. So it's been a rough ride the beginning of this year. But through December, the S&P was actually up 7% for the year. It was up a positive 1.38%. You know, not the 7% return that you need for your pension plan. And then you can look at growth versus value. Growth significantly outperformed value for that period. And a lot of that had to do with the big names, the Google, the Amazons, really led the market last year. If we move on to bonds on page 10, just quickly look at that. We had talked about the ag, but long bonds were down. We're down 3% for the year, the Barclays long government. Mortgages were slightly positive for the year, up 1.51%. And you can see high yield was affected for this year. And high yield, of course, is affected because of equities. There's a link between high yield bonds and equities because high yield bonds is mostly corporate bonds. And then you can see on page 11, you can see the shift in the yield curve. So you've got the dotted green line is the yield curve as of 9/30. And as the Fed raised rates, you could see that rates moved up more in the short term. And on the long term, not so much of a jump up in rates. And then I always like to talk a little bit about the noteworthy developments that we put in here. These market conditions are the same. I know I sometimes sound like a broken record. We go over the same stuff every quarter, but I mean, I think that's important. And they update GDP, they update inflation, so you can always read those to get those. But on pages 18 and 19 are the noteworthy developments. And so these are different from quarter to quarter. They pick something out of the market that they think is interesting that we want to bring to our clients that is happening. So we talk about the Fed. We talk about high yield. We talk about venture capital, companies staying private longer and sort of why that is. And then we talk about correlations between equity and manufacturing, which is also interesting. I'm not going to go through those, but I just want to highlight them if you're interested in reading them. We'll go to your performance. So if we just go over to page 24, which I had talked about earlier, and I know we have a couple new members here. I don't go through the full report, but there's lots of stuff in this report. You're welcome to anytime go through the full report. And if you have questions on pages, you know, you could call me, email me, let me know questions. But there's a lot more in this book than I go over for the short time that I have here. So page 24, this is your targets. These are in your policy index. This is what your policy says, where your assets need to be. That's on the left. And then your current allocations are on the right. And so we check this on a quarterly basis to make sure we're in line with your policy index, to make sure we're compliant with what it says you're supposed to be doing. So large cap is at 13.5. You are at 14.78. Small cap, your target's at 6.5. You're at 17.43. And if you'll notice, you have a range there on the right-hand side. So as long as we don't deviate too much, we're still within our range. Your target to international is 22, you're at 19.8. And if you look at this maybe for the first time, we didn't decide to make equity, international equity less than its target. It's just as markets move, if international doesn't do as well as other things, then it's gonna come down in its allocation. And then when we do rebalance, if we need to rebalance, that way you're sort of buying when something's low and selling when something's high. That's what the whole policy is set to. And the research shows out there, if you do stick to your policy, if you're a board that can really stick to your policy and you sell something when it's creeped up in its allocation to buy into something that maybe is not done as well, you actually do better than your peers because you're really buying at a lower point for that asset class and selling at a higher point for another asset.
That kind of the dogs of the fat Dow theory?
A little bit. And so Fixed income, your target's 32, you're at 31.9, so right on there. Real estate, your target's at 12.5, you're at 11.47. And your alternatives, you're at 13.5 and you're at 12.75. And your target to cash is zero and you're at 1.86. But that's cash that either Alicia needs to pay things or she tells me she needs to allocate it. So we had a little bit of extra cash that we did allocate to international. Again, that's so that idea of buying at a lower point in international. So she, I think, sent money to Templeton, what, a week?
Friday.
So that was a good thing. Not a lot of money, but a little bit if she has some money around. And the reason the target cash is zero, you sort of have a mandate to always stay invested. You know, if you have cash, you'll keep a little bit of cash on hand that you need 1 or 2 months, but in general, you have a mandate to stay fully invested. Move on to performance on page 25. So for the quarter, you were up 1.66, a little bit under your policy of 2.3. And you have to remember, your policy has a strict benchmark for alternatives. You've got alternatives at 13.5%. The benchmark's T-bills plus 5. So that's a difficult when markets are negative, and you've got a PIMCO who has money in equities and other things. To meet a T-bills plus 5 on a very short term from a quarter-to-quarter basis can be difficult. So just be careful when you look at policy index that it's really over the long term that we want you to outperform that policy, not short term you're going to see some fluctuations. Year to date you were negative, not quite 1%, but negative 0.9. 3 years you were at 8%, 5 years 7.45, 10 years 10.64, 7 years 10.64, 10 years 5.79, and since inception 5.87. And now, this is not the inception of the fund, this is the inception of when you hired us, which is in 2000. Lots of funds who, if they look at their inceptions from the 80s, are probably in the 9% range, 9.5% range, even with the downturns. The next page, page 26, just shows you your fiscal years. Your fiscal is a little different than annual. You end in September, so you have to look at all your returns over a September period. So you had 2008, you came out of the 2008 period, you had a negative 17 and a negative 1, so those were very difficult years. And then you came out of that to have a 10% return, then a 1% return, 18, 15, 9, and then a slight negative return for last fiscal year. We'll go through the managers quickly, so that's page 28. Wedge Capital underperformed slightly for the quarter, but outperform for the year to date, and they're outperforming on the 3, 5, 7 year and since inception. Wellington outperformed for the quarter, outperformed for the year to date period, slightly under still 3 years, and they sort of had a tough time when you first hired them, so they're sort of still digging themselves out of the hole there since inception, but their more recent performance is good. Siegel Bryant Hamill outperformed for the quarter significantly by over 1%. Year to date, negative, underperforming the benchmark. 3 years right on there, and then since inception, a little bit under the benchmark there. So it looks like they're pulling themselves out of a little bit of a hole there since inception, too. Templeton has money in emerging markets, and so when emerging markets does well, they'll outperform the EAFE. When emerging markets doesn't do as well, they're going to look more like the ACWI, which is the second benchmark under there. That's why we have two. So they did underperform for the quarter, but if you look at the year-to-date versus the ACWI, they've done well. 3 year, 5 year, 7 year, they're above. They're really close to both benchmarks. 10 year, they outperform both benchmarks, and since inception, they've outperformed by over 2%. They're a very strong manager for you, very diversified. Acadian, sort of hired at the worst time. We can't time markets. We would love to time markets, but we're really trying to build your portfolio for a 30-year time frame. We think emerging markets, having countries that are emerging in your portfolio, having China, having those countries, they may not help right today, but over the long term, they're going to be important parts of the world. Brazil, those, you know, it's going to be important. But it is hurt You year-to-date down 17%. 3 years, they did outperform, though negative. And then since inception, they did outperform significantly since inception, even though it's a negative number. Pyramus had a little bit. Pyramus has been a great manager for you, did really well in 2008, but had a tough year, negative versus a 0.55. But look at their 3-year, 5-year, 7-year since inception, strong manager for you. Double Line, a more recent manager you hired when you decided to allocate more money to fixed income because your plan was now a hybrid plan, doing well since you've hired them. UBS, funny that they talked about UBS, so I think they sold a sold a building and sold it to one of your managers, UBS Realty, because this is a core. You have core real estate and you have value-add real estate. Core real estate is just looking for the income. It's almost an offset to fixed income. You know, fixed income, you used to be able to clip the bonds and clip the coupons and get a good yield. Now a lot of people are turning to real estate to do that, these core funds. And that's why, though the core funds don't do as well as that fund that he is talking about, where they're looking at 12%, 14% returns, people just want core funds to be really stable and just get the income. So they're just looking to clip, almost like a coupon on real estate. And that's the UBS fund. But you look year to date, up 12.9. The benchmark did a little bit better than them. 3-year, 5-year, 7-year they're outperforming. 10-year they're outperforming. Since inception they're outperforming. Because they're one of the largest real estate funds there is, they're part of the benchmark. So it becomes really difficult to get a great benchmark for real estate when, you know, the fund you have is part of the, you know, benchmark there. PIMCO, a fund you did vote to fire. Lee and I are going to talk about Invesco in a little bit, I think when he gets to his legal review, but that's a fund you want to get out of there. You know, you're sort of done with PIMCO, you want to move on to somebody better. Atos, you know, flat for the year-to-date period. I didn't put the hedge fund benchmark in there. I need to probably add that so you can see what other hedge funds have done. Again, this is a really positive benchmark that can never go negative, so that's difficult. But you can see they did outperform it for the 3-year, a little bit below on the 5-year. 7-year, they outperformed it. And since inception, they're a little bit below. And then your cash fund. And if you flip to page 30, you'll see this is closed-end real estate. They come on a different page and because they are not calculated the same way as, like, stock funds, you know, because they're not valued on a daily basis. They're valued on a quarterly basis. And all the column you need to look at for these funds is the since inception column. So Long Wharf, 7.71. Penn did 13. Colony did 22. Town Square did 17. That's another one of the Penn funds. So if Penn has another fund that comes out, we'll want to look at them. They've done very well for you. And then Westport's a newer fund that you hired. And there's a J-curve. When they come out, it's very difficult. They buy funds and they don't do well right away. You have to wait a little bit before you see the pop-up there for returns. And that's it for your fund. And we can talk about any managers you want to. I think you have a solid lineup of managers. It's been a really tough market. And I think switching out PIMCO is a good idea. So that'll be important to get that done. But I don't have any recommendations to fire anybody or anything like that. I try to not talk too much. I'm going to talk a lot.
Okay, with the quarterly report?
Mm-hmm.
Motion to accept it as it is.
We'll see you about the next time.
Yeah.
Things aren't looking great. Motion to accept.
Second.
It's all approved.
Aye.
Unanimous. Aye.
So we had a special meeting to talk about hedging, hedging opportunities. So I'm going to sort of open the floor to that discussion. The issue with the hedging was that when we ended up going through everything with Parametric, it looked like we'd have to give away sort of a lot of the upside and the costs associated with the actual overlay of the whole portfolio may be very expensive for the fund. We didn't really talk about the defensive equity strategy that they have, which is a product which you might be able to put in as a product if you wanted to, maybe part of your alternatives portfolio or something like that.
So. Could we get them to present that? Because we really didn't get into...
I was going to talk about that. I didn't know if that's something you want them to come in at the next meeting and present that product, or how you wanted to sort of proceed with that. And I also brought in some mixes because I wanted to talk to you about mixes because I had talked about it the last meeting, talking about mixes. So I sort of need to know the direction you want to go.
I'm kind of jumping already on my comments, you know, to six as far as the overlay is concerned. What I found not really disconcerting, but in that session was the fact that, you know, they were so negative, you know, in terms of what they do for a living, you know, in terms of, you know, most people lose money on options, you know, and so forth. And, well, you're absolutely right, particularly if they're not covered. And, you know, timing is everything. Obviously, if we would have employed a risk overlay, you know, early in last summer, perhaps we wouldn't be where we are now as far as the equity is concerned. So, again, I'm kind of out of place here, but I'd really like to see us give some thought to a risk overlay that we would have on the shelf.
Oh, when they briefly went over, it was pretty expensive, though.
Well, yeah, it depends. It wouldn't have been last
right.
summer. See,
yes.
that's the
yes.
point. That's the
so
point.
So now you're trying to buy insurance for things. Yeah,
you know, when the house is burning,
right.
You know, insurance is going to be priced high. When you think, well, you know, I got a lot of trees in the neighborhood, maybe I ought to go buy some insurance. It's been a dry summer. You know, you can still perhaps buy some insurance that's reasonable. So I just really feel... You know, I'm concerned about the defined benefit pension system, not just here at the city of Ocala, but all over. And if you have the kind of drawdowns that we've had in these last couple of market collapses, you know, I think it does not bode well for defined benefit plans.
I think that the cost is something that you have to just really amongst yourselves really just, you know, really have that conversation about cost and if the insurance is worth the cost. Having a covered call sort of strategy doesn't seem to really work. I mean, when you look at the math of it, you're going to give up so much of the upside. And then if you do have a surge in the market, if the market goes up 20%, you're going to have participants saying, what did you do? You know, you sold away our upside for downside protection. So I think you really have to, if you want the insurance, which, you know, absolutely up to, if that's something that's very of concern to you, you have to write a check for it, I think. You have to decide that you want to write a check for that downside protection and then the impact that that's going to have on your portfolio. So I think that that's the conversation. I can get it priced for you if you want. I mean, they'll do that. They'll price it. But I think that that's the thing. You have to write a check for the downside and know that that's what you're doing.
But what I heard y'all say is now's not the time.
Right,
to
that's
write
very
a check
expensive right now. Yeah.
So I would say no, now.
No.
Maybe in better times.
But you have to, you know, the way prices. We operate, we meet every 3 months, you know, to meet off schedule. You know, I mean, the world could end, you know, sometime. And that's why I'm saying if we thought through something and we have it there, then if you're going to go ahead and implement it, it's a matter of having a meeting, talking about it, and saying, all right, we pull the trigger, whereas now we're still, what is it, you know, or how can it be utilized? That's all I'm saying. I would just like to see where we have given thorough thought and then decide if we want to put something like that on the shelf.
So I look at it as a short-term type protection, and we're always dealing with long-term investments. And we know that everything's going to cycle. So for sure, I don't see us being up near the peak for a little while. I mean, we're due for a fall, if you actually look at it, as a 7-year, but things have changed quite a bit. But we do see we're slowly starting to decay a little bit, so I don't think right now is the perfect time to talk about this.
Not implementing it.
Right, absolutely.
But in terms of talking about...
Well, I guess, you know, I would say table it until things are going back onto a positive swing, and then maybe we could really endeavor into it and get some ideas. But right now, I know when we talked to them, it seemed like it was very expensive. And I don't know if we could afford something like that. I mean, I had Alicia print out a few things that, you know, if you see it's on you, you know, it's like how much we spend in fees, and this doesn't include our attorney fees and the other things. I mean, we have a lot of money going out right now that I'm not willing to consider right now. But I understand, you know, table it, but not forget about it. Well, I guess I squashed that. Sorry, Bertie.
I did want to show you, if you do look in these books with that funny sort of arrow on it, if you just look on page 5, because we talked about risk, and it's important to always talk about risk. I mean, if we can talk about risk all the time, I think it's important. Risk is a big deal, and it's this one, Bernie.
The smaller one.
Sorry. page 5. This is what we did. This is the last asset allocation study we did, and you know, sometimes even I forget things, so I just want to make sure we sort of remember where we were, where we've come from, to where we are now. Your target used to be there in that left-hand column. So your target to fixed income was only 14%. You had 46% in U.S. equities. You had 19% in international equities. That puts your total amount in equities in excess of like 67% of your portfolio. That was huge, right? And especially for a plan that went hybrid, 10% in hedge funds, 10% in real estate. You went all the way to P4. And this is a dramatic difference from your peers. So just so you know where other public pension plans are, a lot of them are still here, still at where you were. And in 2014, Bernie was a proponent of this, and Arnie, you know, with closing your plan, you're lowering your assumption. I mean, you moved to this portfolio. Look at the bottom where it shows standard deviation. Your standard deviation was 12, you moved to P3, sorry. Your standard deviation was 12.9. You took your standard deviation all the way down to 9.1. Not only that, your Sharpe ratio went up. You always want your Sharpe ratio to go up. That means for every unit of risk you're taking, you're getting more return for that unit of risk, okay, and making you a more efficient portfolio. Your Sharpe ratio went from 0.3 to 0.34. And look at that. You went down from a 67% in equities. You went down to 42% in equities. That's a huge change. That's a lot of risk you took off the table. Yes, do you still have equity risk in your portfolio? Yes. Yes, you do. But a lot less. A lot less than you did. So if anybody ever came to you as a board and said, hey, what are you people doing? Right? The newspaper. What are you people doing with these pension funds? You're investing in equities. Equities are all over. You're taking all this risk with these pension dollars. Well, Bernie's saying, what the newspapers say about, oh, you're a fiduciary. Shouldn't you be... You could say to people, you could show them this page, look what we did. We're trying to be prudent here. We're trying to take risk off the table. We're trying to secure these assets for the long term. And that's what we're trying to do. And that's what you did in 2000. And this is not, I don't want anybody to think this is stagnant. We look at this. We continue to look at this. We do studies every 2 or 3 years to make sure we're still on track. But it's important for that to be known, be in the minutes of the meeting, that we, you know, that you do that, and you should be commended for that, because not a lot of pension funds have the, you know, have the cojones to really, you know, to do it. So
where would you say our fund fell on the spectrum up top? And I know, didn't we talk about measuring our risk?
Yeah.
And you priced it, it was $30,000 or something.
Yeah, we talked about risk. But if you just look, you could sort of plot it, because if you look at the standard deviation, so you would have been at 12, almost 13, so you could plot it there. And then your return would be like a 7.5, so you were sort of down here a little bit. And any point on this line is an efficient portfolio. You just want to make sure, you know, for the amount of risk you're taking, you're getting return for that. So you didn't actually drop your return too much from 7.5 to 7.1, but you actually went way down on your risk level.
Yep.
So. At this discussion that we did have at that January meeting, we talked about dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, I think we've somewhat been dynamic, but I think you were talking about actually a strategy where we're formally.
Yeah, I was thinking of putting something in your policy, and I can write you up some language for your policy statement. I think you might want to write something that it's linked to your funded ratio. And as your funded ratio gets higher, that might indicate a study to be done to see the ways we can lower our risk as our funding. And I can write some language that maybe you could adopt to put in your policy that would help for that. If you want me to do that for the next meeting, I can do that.
Please.
And I did give you this. This comes annually. It wasn't ready to put in the books. It's usually in the back of your books. And this is just your fees. Arnie loves to look at this. Mm-hmm. We used to do it quarterly. We just do it annually now. But I want to make sure it was done for the meeting. And sorry it wasn't in your books. But these are your fees. The only way I would say, if you really wanted to reduce fees, your managers have been doing really well, is that you could index. You know, indexing lowers fees. You could take your whole equity portfolio and index it if you wanted to. Those managers have added value after fees over time. So, you know, but that's always something to consider. But other than that, I think your fees are reasonable. We always try to negotiate them to the lowest that we can get for you. But that's all I would say about that.
Rose, if I could ask you this also, mm-hmm. in terms of these equity managers, I would presume their approach is not totally fundamental.
Right, they have a top-down and a bottom-up approach to investing in stocks.
And do they use technical metrics in terms of the determination of when to get in and when to get out of stuff, or do they just look at the company from a fundamental standpoint, and when they get here, they get out, and when they get there, they get out?
Yeah, I mean, they're basically looking at a sort of a price target for a stock. So if they see a stock that they really like, if it's priced too high, they can't buy it now. But they have that sort of on their list, and when it hits a lower price target, they're going to buy it. And then they sort of set a price target for a sell. So they don't keep, you know, you never want them to keep their winners, fall in love with their winners. You want them to trim, make money, and then buy something else that's cheap. And so that's what they're doing. And I think that's all for my stuff.
And if I could ask Alicia, is all of this on as a attachments to email, everything that we're looking at?
Everything but at Ron Wolf's book. We didn't have that information before the meeting.
But I can get it for you if I have it electronically.
I would just ask, and I think I brought it up at the last meeting or perhaps the one before that, that if there's anything that winds up on this table, if we could also have it electronically, so that, you know, this can be disposed of, if you follow what I'm saying, but I still have access to it.
I send everything of ours to Alicia electronically, so.
All right, Lee, what you got for us?
Number of things. I'll go down what's on the agenda first, and I've got a few things in addition to that. And first on is the Invesco contract. Rose alluded to this earlier. We had a conference with their representatives and one of their attorneys on Friday, and there were several items that I requested be changed in the contract. One of them was confidentiality. We could not agree to that because of our public records law in Chapter 119 and Sunshine in 286. I objected to the indemnification provision. The board, if agreeing to that, would be taking on a contingent liability that could be significant depending what happened. Does happen, and I told them we couldn't agree to that. No, obviously, it's obviously the board's decision, but I would not recommend it. They made all the changes that I requested with the exception of indemnification. But that could be significant, particularly the way theirs is drafted. So Rose and I spoke, and I got this late on the document back late Friday, and Rose and I spoke this morning, and I brought her up to date on it, and she put a call through to a representative of Invesco, who presumably will get back with us, but again, I wouldn't recommend entering into the agreement with indemnification in there.
So my question is, if they can't agree to indemnification, I wasn't here for the Wellington presentation, but I don't, if they were your second choice, would you be interested in going with Wellington, or how would you feel about that? I know I think we might have in the past picked second choices in these kind of situations.
We have before, but yeah, I don't agree with the indemnification thing.
Yeah, it kind of goes along with what your comments were earlier. You know, high fees and taking on a liability which you would only be strapped with pursuant to your agreeing to it, that that wouldn't look good in the papers.
No, and that's pretty much the city's stance too.
Well, obviously that's what we have to look at here because they're the final indemnitor. I mean, it's the city of Ocala.
And
obviously we need to be thinking about the community.
Yeah, and essentially the indemnification is if there is a problem, not only do we have to defend it, but we've got to pay for their defense and hold them heartless, and it could be a bottomless
The city stance, and I work with a lot of contracts with a lot of people, and we just don't do it.
So I think then when Rose talks to a representative of the company, she can say it's a deal breaker. You either take it out or it's a deal breaker.
And I'd like an answer before the end of this month so then we can proceed with Wellington.
And we know that we can get a contract with Wellington because
we have it before.
You have one before, so that shouldn't be an issue. So if you want to vote for that, if we fall through with the Invesco to go with them, if that's what you'd like to do, but if not, then we can try to go back to the drawing board.
It's hard enough for me to remember.
I understand,
the Wellington situation. I wish I could look at the, not even the minutes, but perhaps the recording for that.
How we assess them and how we take them?
And we can bring them back. I can bring Wellington to the next meeting. I mean,
well, that's just putting it off, and I think that's what Arnie
I'm already yelling at Lee that we're putting things off, and of course, you know, sometimes it's because he's waiting for things like this, and it's not fair to him if I call him up and it's like, hey, where are we? And then we find out, you know, there's these issues. And
whether they would come back, I would just like to revisit the...
They would definitely come back. They have no problem coming back. Right. I mean, that's not...
You want to do that?
I don't know. I kind of looked at we rate them and, you know, and then we move on. And sure, we could delay it and put them off, or I don't think it warrants, you know, a special meeting. I mean, but then again, we want to continue.
I mean, did you interview three? Did you interview Wellington and Invesco and somebody else, or did you just interview two?
I think you were three.
I think it was three.
I think from Rob's notes, Rob was here and he gave me notes. I think that Wellington was your second choice from what my recollection of what he told me.
I just show we interviewed Nesco and Wellington.
Just the two. That's all that's in the minutes. That's what I'm looking at right now. So
it would be more of a default than it would be a choice, because there were only two and they finished last, if you will.
I think that we had a couple other funds that we liked, but we knew we couldn't get contracts with. It's a little bit harder to get contracts Florida than some other of my plans, so.
Well, not to go back or go forward in terms of the agenda, but is this perhaps something now that we should perhaps look at the parametrics?
Maybe you can look at their fund.
At our next meeting and see how that would fit in, and maybe have Wellington come back that day as well.
It's a different, you know,
it's a different investment, so therefore we're talking about, you know, restructuring.
Two investments.
Yeah.
But obviously, if we're going to, you know, discuss, to maybe just have that as part of that particular meeting. But you know, I defer to the chair.
I mean, hopefully we can get Invesco to come through. I mean, I just have to talk to them. I don't know, you know, if I can give them a hard, we're going somewhere else type thing. Maybe that'll push it through. Lee, you said you had a contract with Invesco, an older one. Does it not have that kind of stuff in it?
No, it goes back to 94, and it does not have those provisions.
They didn't think that stuff back then.
I tell them. Well, we want that contract.
Yeah. Who was Invesco replacing?
Pimco.
For fixed Pimco.
Right.
No, for global tactical asset allocation. It's like a balanced type fund, and they invest in different asset classes.
Who else would we have to look at besides Wellington?
There's not a lot of people out there. I mean, not that we'd like to do it. I mean, a lot of people do it, but ones that we have recommended. I forgot what the other one was. We probably have five or six on our recommended list, but to get them to agree to all the legal stuff.
Right.
And that's what happened in Cape Coral. I brought in, I think, Invesco and Wellington there too, because they were the ones. See, Invesco said ahead of time that they could agree to everything, and then.
Right. So this is a do or die thing, but my thoughts are, instead of going through this pain, by looking at the way the market is, should we restructure instead? I mean, I'd rather spend my time on that, because we're not really hitting our numbers anyway. I would rather spend a meeting with restructuring, which is, to me, the natural progression of what we have to do anyway, since they froze the plan.
What I can do is go back to my research group and say, hey, we have this spot. You know, we were going to fill it with Invesco. Maybe there's something else we should fill it with. You know, you got about 6% of the portfolio in that alternative space. And maybe it's the parametric part. Maybe 3% goes to parametric. Maybe 3% goes to something else. But find, you know, something in there. That spot's not supposed to earn a lot. It's not supposed to earn like 12, 15%, but it's supposed to earn around 8, 7, or 8, or 9.
Losing right now, so.
Right, and that's what it's supposed to earn over time. So we've got to sort of find with a lower level of risk, and that's what PIMCO did. Really low level of risk, but they're not delivering the return. That's why you want to fire them. And so we can talk about to my research group and see what else they think might fit that alternatives bucket for you, with the same kind of characteristics that's in your asset allocation, because you want to be able to have the same kind of risk return calculations. So. But if Invesco goes through, then we can move forward there.
So I say if they can't give you a response by the end of the month, and you ask your research team to,
okay,
and you bring them forward next meeting.
Okay.
I think with the discussions we've had to date up through Friday,
they're not going to change.
There's not a lot of thinking for them to do beyond this. We have the lawyer on the phone, we have the salespeople on the phone, we have their manager on the phone, Rose was on the phone, so
they're standing there.
Really
well, no, they changed the language. They changed the language of the indemnification. It's just not
but it's substantively says the same thing.
Correct, but we can go back to that.
It's open to interpretation now, huh?
But I think, I would think they'd be able to give you an answer this week.
Yeah, we have to be indemnified from that kind of stuff.
And Rose, you mentioned you sort of, you know, play hardball with them, but that's what I understand the board is saying. They're saying either...
That's what I'm saying. I just have to get buy-in from everyone and...
Or no deal. It's a deal breaker.
Right. That's what we'll say to them.
Did Cape Coral make a choice yet? Did Cape Coral make a choice on...
They went with Wellington.
They made a choice.
So, are you looking?
I'm kind of looking for somebody to make a motion. I mean, surely I could hand over my position and make the motion myself.
Well, I'll
take it back. It's the only other way I can make a motion.
Well, I'll make the motion that if Invesco does not agree to remove that indemnity requirement, that we go with Wellington, since the space for this kind of manager is kind of, and I'm saying that would be more for discussion, but I'll make the motion that we would go with Wellington.
You want to do that by default, or do you want them back?
I'm okay with them.
You're okay with just default?
Yeah.
It's not a huge sum of money. It's
$6 million is a lot of money.
Well, I understand, but...
Wellington's a good manager. They're recommended by us. We like them. They've managed money successfully for you in the past, different asset class, but...
Who presented for Invesco? Who were the folks that presented?
I don't know. I think what Rob said was something about the risk level between Invesco and Wellington was what your concern was.
I remember Wellington, they used tons of options. They were using...
Derivatives
mm-hmm. is what
to
I
get
recall.
At their positions probably. Mm-hmm. He said that I think you felt like Invesco did it in a more measured way or did it in a more conservative way than Wellington did. That was what Rob said to me when it came out of the meeting, because he thought you guys were going to pick Wellington. And he was like, he called me after the meeting, was like, oh no, they went with Invesco. They felt like they did it, and he's like, they like both, but they felt like Invesco did it in a more conservative way.
So open up the minutes real quick to page 2. It really talks about our discussion where we talked about the better risk return, that Invesco had a better risk return than Wellington.
Arnie, you're the only one that has the minutes.
Oh, really?
I emailed them to everyone, so I just give them to you.
I'll be happy to let you read. It's only one quick paragraph if you want right here. Under C, the manager. Sorry, Lee. Hold you up for a minute.
What's that?
Holding you up.
That's fine.
Get to read it, John.
Mm-hmm.
You want to read it real quick? That only takes a second. I mean, my mindset is that we have to put the money somewhere. We know Pinto's, you know, not doing great. Invesco, if they decide to go, and they're not, it looks like they don't want to indemnify us, so we go at Wellington. I mean, we can always move the money again, but...
So they want us to indemnify them.
Right. Not going to. We need to be indemnified.
Again, this is where the transcript
right.
would help, because obviously it fills in the blank. But my motion stands that we would accept Wellington if...
Are you okay with that? All those four? Aye.
Aye.
It's unanimous. Wells Fargo.
Okay, I drafted and provided triplicates of custody agreement with Wells Fargo, which these are certainly acceptable legally, and we could have the board sign today and then send to Wells Fargo for their execution.
to kind of discuss that, where we're changing, getting away. Ordinance change.
Okay, the drop provisions of the ordinance have been amended, and they're incorporated in ordinance now, which primarily provides for 60-month participation period measured from the time of first eligibility to go into the drop. And it also, with respect to earnings, provides a tie-in to the plan, but not be more than 3 or less than 0. Those are major substantive changes.
The only question I have is the ordinance doesn't specifically address what happens to earnings over 3% that don't go into the drop.
Stays in the plan.
Yeah, but it doesn't say that specifically. So I've seen it addressed myself.
So I just assumed if you're telling them they're getting 0 to 3, anything over 3 stays in the plan.
Are you in the plan until they're paid out?
That's really covered under other provisions in the ordinance.
Yeah, I mean, to me it was understood, but are you saying he wants to see it in the ordinance in black and white, or?
If he wanted to know, like, if it went to the unfunded liability, which, yeah, I mean, that's what it goes.
Well, to. Yeah, it stays in the plan. Right.
That was my assumption, which is why I didn't.
Yeah, other provisions in the ordinance provide the money that's in the plan. That actually provides, that'll be money
taken away from
taken
you.
Out. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Okay. Yeah, not to be morbid, but people who, you know, pass away, money stays in the plan, right? So you're okay with this?
Okay.
All right. And John's okay, other than that one clarification?
We'll see, make
sure you
write it in there.
Okay. We've done the agenda item, and it's, I think, the second meeting in March. Once we get it back signed by everybody, I'll get a copy out to everyone so they can add to their books. Connie and Anthony will have new books for you at the next meeting. We have to wait for you, actually.
And is the current policy, the current asset allocation, like, you know, that part of the ordinance that I update, is that updated? Do you know that if that reflects what's in here? And if not, can I just review it so I can make sure that's updated if you're going to do that anyways? I just want to make sure that it matches.
Okay. I just have to ask, because I'm not sure, why does the mayor even get to sign an ordinance? He really doesn't have a...
Because he has veto power over ordinance.
Oh, okay.
That's the only really legislative power he has. He can't veto anything else. The council can override anything.
Right. That's what I thought, so that's why I was...
I think almost every time he's vetoed something, come back and override him. If it wasn't unanimous the first time, it is when they override him.
So it's kind of a courtesy. He gets his name on something,
yes.
Right? Yeah. Okay. Just...
I just want to make sure it's updated with my part from 14 when they voted to change it. It usually changes in the ordinance, so. But my memory is not great, so I want to make sure that happened.
That's Bernie's line, not yours.
Okay. Well, a lot of stuff happened to me in 14, so I just want to double check that all stuff was done, because I know people subbed for me at meetings and stuff like that. I want to make sure that that's in there.
And if I could go back to my thing about having everything in digital format, conceivably it's there already. And I'm asking for redundancy, yes. Because if I go to the city website, mm-hmm. and I go to the agenda, because mm-hmm. remember, I couldn't print the PDF the other day on the agenda off of my email, but I went there and I was able to print it, and it said it was 180 some odd pages.
Yes,
and
I get the material before the meeting, it's on there. If there's something that comes in Thursday, Friday, or handed out in the meeting, it's not on the website.
But can it get on the website? That's where I'm going.
That I don't think so. The agenda has to be posted legally so many hours before.
Because I'm trying to eliminate redundancy, if you follow what I'm saying. So it's a matter of timing and legality as far as the website is concerned. Well, again, if everything then could be in the form of
and you'll just have to. You're the only one that wants all of those items. So if we don't get them to you, just
The problem becomes, I don't have to think about what I don't have. See, that's it. I would just like to know that I had everything by virtue of the fact that
we will try. Yeah. But we're in meetings all day, so we don't even get back to our offices tomorrow.
Yeah. And it's not that I need it today or I need it yesterday. It's just that it's there. And that brings up the book that members of this board get. Could that book not be available online?
Yes.
Because then, as Mr. Ortiz over here, he can
I don't have somewhere I can just put it online where anyone can view that. I can email it to you in parts, but I can't email you the whole thing because of the size.
So to sidetrack you, I remember once we had a meeting about emails. Does Bernie have an email here with the city so we know everything is...
Some do, some don't. We went through and found that some were using their personal email versus the retiree, and John deleted some of them that had never been used. So we haven't issued new ones either.
Jessica, I'm going to ask you to step up here. It's all for retention purposes, but...
I mean, we have everything that's here. We have
everything you send is saved anyway, right?
Yes. Now, as far as electronic, yes and no. So, I mean, what I hand you out, I have, but what Lone Wharf gave us, unless they sent something Friday, I don't have the electronic copy. I can request it, and usually when I request it, I can get it.
Right. Louise, this just makes sense for retention that everybody has a backed up email service, so we use the city's email addresses for these kind of correspondences, or it's not really necessary?
No, it's not necessary, but I do recommend if you're doing email, you don't use your personal email. Because if you commingle your personal matters with your pension matters and there's a public records request,
they could subpoena in your PC and take it from you. Tony, you found that, follow that, too?
Nah, you've got to do something, don't
you? No, do you understand what I'm saying,
yeah,
though? So if you were doing some pension stuff on your personal email,
right,
and somebody suspected something, they could, subpoena in your PC,
right,
because there's commingled information on it. So that's one of the reasons why I was suggesting that,
The dear old Sunshine Left.
Right.
So you can get an address from Alicia or from the webmaster, which would be ocalaflorida.org, and conceivably everybody should use that, and I know I was the one that made the noise to do that, and then I tried to utilize it and somehow I pressed the wrong button and I can't use it, but I've got to spend the time and get with the webmaster.
We have the ability to fix it.
I'm sure you do.
So you'd have a jaywalk or an Ocala Athletic.org that we can put into your phone or give you, the URL so you can get to it on any PC.
Right.
But this way, you can set with personal business.
Good idea.
All right. So if you'd please engage with, I don't know if it's still John Booth's or if they're passing it on to one of the newer guys now that they have some new people. But
I'll check it out.
All right, cool.
Is it public information, Alicia?
It is.
So maybe put it on the website.
Well, that's what we're thinking. Well, we don't really have anywhere, you know what I mean? I've got a retiree's corner, but it's more or less member information.
Put in trustees tab or something.
Yeah, we can do like a trustees tab maybe, and we can have it, have a login, IT can set up like a portal, and we can just log in before they see the page. I'm sure there's something we can do. Thank you guys. Thank you.
Do we have to approve this ordinance? Can we just say thanks, Lee?
Yeah, no, you don't have to.
Thanks, Lee. Sorry about the pain and suffering and the perception that you're dragging on some of this stuff, which...
I'm glad you said that, because you're right, the timeframes are often not solely in my control.
I understand that, but, you know, I just wanted to share with you that, you know, some people have the perception that you're just obstinate and you drag stuff, so they always wonder why I call you and I get a response, you know?
Well, you get a response because pretty much you're the only one that calls me.
Well...
Cindy called me a couple weeks ago.
Did he talk to you?
Yeah, I'm always diligent about returning phone calls and things.
You remember that conference call that we sort of mixed up? And he said, well, the reason I didn't put Invesco on the call is because I thought you had trouble getting a hold of Lee. And I said, no, I talk to Lee all the time. I don't need a special conference call to just talk to Lee. I need a conference call to talk to Lee and Invesco. I didn't call Lee. I have no problem getting... I never have a problem getting a hold of you, so...
This year, the drop, we're going to negotiate with the IBEW to see if they want to add this to the contract. So we'll apply to just...
How many votes did it take to get rid of them?
They have to vote themselves. That's the way that it works. You have to vote your own decertification. And if employee engagement is any indication based on the number that showed up to their contract, I don't think you could get them to get together to vote it out. Because they didn't listen that they had to vote yes or no to get their pay hikes. Now, they filled up my office and Jared's office when they didn't get any reasons and wondered what the heck happened. Did you vote was my first question. Well, no, but then I don't have anything to discuss with you.
Yeah, they have to be a little more involved with themselves.
So they would have to vote to desert.
Spread the word?
Take the lead and do what they want.
They would have to vote to desert. This will apply to just...
Just the way it got in is just the way that we get out.
Yeah, well... I can't get involved with that piece.
Nope. None of us can.
Right.
None of us can.
It's sad they voted in something that they can't deal with themselves. Summary plan description.
That's a good segue from what Alicia's told us. When I get a signed copy of this ordinance, then I'll do a new SPD. But I'd like to be up to date through this ordinance.
First week, second week
will
be the first meeting.
Okay, great.
So that's all you need. You're ready to rock and roll and give it to us.
As soon as I get a signed copy of the ordinance, yep.
Okay.
A couple other things also.
Go ahead.
Okay, you may recall we discussed, Arnie and I discussed it a few weeks ago. We talked about a tax review of our plan by the law firm Dice Miller out of Indianapolis. And we work with complex tax matters with them frequently. And they actually, the board had asked me to get a price from them, how much it would cost, and they gave us a not to exceed $6,000. And then that was put on hold pending changes that maybe.
So I'm curious, what we asked Diane to go out and get, is that not similar, or when Diane was here, that we said we needed some tax opinions on what was going on?
Yep. They just looked at one specific items on the ordinance, not the entire ordinance. The reason for this was the changes that were made, and you do have a unique structure now. There's only one or two other ones in the United States. That was the reason.
Do you follow that, or do you want to have some discussion on it?
What is it now to go? I thought we put it on the shelf until we found out where the city was maybe going to go with the...
I don't think the city's going to change their ideas and thoughts about the pension the way it is today. I think they want some of the risk taken care of by some of the employees, and I don't think they're going to change that particular stance. I mean, so the variable rate, I mean, I tried to push to go to a fixed number to get away from this variable, and I didn't get enough opinions from the employees. I mean, I think it was a 201 to 200 vote, And that's when I decided, I mean, it's 50-50. Why even, you know, climb up on my soapbox if I don't even see enough, you know, wanting to do something? You know, it takes a lot of energy for me to go out and solicit all the employees and mentor them. And that's really what they need. And I'm getting older. I'm just not willing to, you know, invest this much time and energy in these people that don't want to take ownership and responsibility in their own, you know, lives. As it is, I mean, I'm here for the pension plan itself. And, I mean, the variable rate, I mean, we're managing the money. But it's what the employees get out of it.
Yeah, but we're doing more than managing the money because I think that if we're dealing with the employees, then we're advocating for the employees, if you follow what I'm saying. You hear me out for a second?
Okay.
And I think we should be advocating for the plan. And when I say advocating for the plan, I mean, how is it best to achieve the goal that was intended by this defined benefit plan? And that conceivably this hybrid thing that we have now is not the best way to have this plan structured, that by having it structured in this way, we achieve the same goal, but it becomes more understandable to all of the players, which would be the city, which would be the community, which would be the employees.
Right.
So, you know, what I'm saying is it really doesn't involve speaking to Joe and Mo, because then if Joe and Mo want to have some input, if this ever gets to a forum where a decision is made, then they can, those that are interested can.
So what I proposed was I passed out a questionnaire. Before I'm willing to climb up on my soapbox and try to take on counsel to get to a defined benefit, because they're trying to indemnify themselves from some of the losses and get the employees involved a little bit, what I proposed was the employees kick in a smaller additional percentage into their pension plan to show a little bragging and some stabilization from the employees too. And when I got a 50-50 mix, that's when I'm like, you know, it's going to take a lot of effort and a lot of schooling to explain. It's sad, but some of these people still think the union is going to take care of them. And you have no idea what it takes to explain to these people when they think that they're relinquishing the city to be responsible for their retirement and they're passing it over to an IBEW, which is a strong union. I mean, they're big, and they're saying, oh, we're going to take care of you. But the people aren't digging into what are the particulars. I mean, they don't know they have to buy an A card. They don't know what an A card is going to cost them. All they hear is that, you know, the union is going to take care of them. And we have a naive group of people that I just don't want to waste my efforts to explain to them what it really means in the big picture of things. And I sometimes think ultimately the city is responsible for educating the employees, not the pension board. Our fiduciary responsibilities are to the plan. And since I've already taken this battle on twice already, trying to work with the employees, I mean, I get disheartened. I mean, it's sad, but these people really just think that they get a job and the city's going to take care of them, and they're naive. It's almost to the point of the proper term is ignorance. It's lack of education, and who should educate these people?
Do you want to be educated?
Well, some of them just want to be naive, you know? Ignorance is bliss, right? I mean, they're happy as can be.
We did a huge education campaign when the switches happened, and we still have people come in and say, I mean, no plan they're in.
Right. So we have some people in the DC that haven't even assigned their beneficiaries. They come in and say, well, I didn't know how to do that. There's all kinds of information out there.
There's videos.
Yes, there's a representative that comes in once a month.
I mean, you can only spoon feed so much to people who are not.
There's only so much we can do.
Well,
You've done your due diligence.
You have no idea how many times I've gone and I've talked to departments and, you know, and...
The union has said at this point that they plan to bring a plan amendment in 18. So they told me, just relax, we'll take care of it in 18. We're going to undo this whole thing in 18. I don't know how they think they're going to undo the whole thing, but...
When it's been in effect for 5 years.
The other thing you might want to do is bring the union officials in and try to get them on board, you know, and explain to them, you know, and then allow them to, you know, help educate the employees.
Yeah, I think my problem is that I can't cross that line.
You what?
They're going to even educate the employees on that.
I agree, you know, I'm not saying that's going to be the be-all, end-all, but in addition to doing some other education.
Randy, I mean, let's just turn it and look at your firefighters. I mean, a lot of the junior guys just know that they come in and, you know, it is what it is. You know, it's, I don't...
Well, I spend a lot of time educating. I'm going around to every single station today, talking to the people, talking to every one of the firefighters about what their individual benefits are, and I pass out individual sheets to every single firefighter, and I explain to them, you know, what's going on with their, you know, with their pension plan, with the changes that are about to come up, and all that stuff.
You've been doing that for years, right, Randy?
Sorry?
You've been doing that for years.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you have Randy, who's an advocate,
well, that's
but
the
problem is you don't have anyone else, and you're a smaller group of people, too.
Right.
Right.
Come and go, you know, it's like you just...
We have a bigger, we have a more diverse population. Everyone in the firefighters, they're all in the same plan. They're all in the same plan in the union.
Right.
Yeah. They're in the DC, the DBPH, and the DB. So the advocate or the education person needs to be trilingual.
Right, and the problem is some of these people don't even know what plans are in.
I think I'm the only one who's trilingual. I don't know.
Well, your voice comes back soon. Good to see you.
Thanks.
Happy Monday.
So when you do this new plan, are the people that are in the D.C. going to be allowed to come back in or not?
So we started looking at that, and when I didn't see enough buy-in, I just decided, you know, my career path's getting too short,
right,
that I want to invest too much of my personal time, because, as I said, you have a smaller group, and for me, it's explicit, you know, to get everything printed out and go visit each person. And then the next thing you know, I become a mentor, and I'm sitting there and I'm advising them, and I can't advise them.
Right, right. And I don't advise. I tell them, these are the positives, these are the negatives, the decision is yours. These are some of the positives and some of the negatives. But what I, if you can just limit it to that, if you can get the number that if they're not going to be allowed to get go from the DC back to the DB, okay, then there you draw your line. And then all the ones that are in the DB, it's only their decision, then just make an effort to go around and educate them, because ultimately it's going to make it, it's going to simplify it for everybody.
I know, but
the actuaries, for the attorneys.
I'm thinking the actuary has to get involved now, as long as the plan's been going out, you know, because everybody's putting in different amounts. And what does that come to? And do we tell everybody they have to come back, or do we give them the option? You know,
no, they already made their choice. They made their choice to go DC.
Right.
So, they're in the
so
DC's
that's
plan.
That's my thought. Is the people who went to DC, that's where you stay.
But would that be legal just to address the people that are in the DB, the ones that have already chosen DC, have made that decision? Or would you have to give them
the ability? I haven't seen those documents, but if it was provided, it was irrevocable and.
That's what we just did with the drop. If you went to the D.C.
Right.
and you hit your 30 years, you
it was
can't.
The election.
You're not eligible.
D.C. was that stated to be irrevocable?
Then all you have to educate are the DB people and not the DC, which is about, what's that cutting in, about 50%?
Yeah, there's like 250, just under 250.
And then once you get the DB people, it's just an education, you know, and it's only a one-time thing. You educate them this one time on this one change, and it's just going to simplify everything for everybody. I don't know, it just seems like that's the way to go to me is, you know, do a one-time educational thing to get this change in, and then you're on cruise control.
Well, I'm not sure with the union coming in how much...
Well, get the union leadership in here and explain to them exactly what's going, you know, exactly what it is, and see if you can get their buy-in.
they want them to go to their plan.
Okay.
That's, yeah. You know what I mean? Well, it's not stay with the city. They want
well,
them
to when you do your education, say this is what your unit is going to tell you. This is what they want to go. And then this is what we think is more reality, and this is what we think is what we think you should do. I don't know.
I'll sit and discuss it with Alicia and see how much work it takes for her to give me the sheets like you have.
We get them. We get these numbers. From, I don't do them for the city, Foster does them.
Mm-hmm.
I do them for fire because they are smaller.
Right.
And we don't have...
Well, and I know we're still getting the spreadsheets, right?
Yeah.
To work with. So we're a little bit closer to being accurate.
Yes. Yes, we do have a spreadsheet now. We can do post.
Did anyone ask you the numbers with them possibly voting to drop back in? How many people become eligible for that?
No.
So they just think that it's a carrot, but they don't really know what it's going to.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, it makes a fine.
It's something the city can offer, but they didn't have to give up anything.
Yeah, but to me, it's a smaller percentage. I mean, that.
0 to 3. So if it's negative, the city doesn't lose anything.
Right.
And if it's over 3, which our assumption is 7.5.
Well, that's okay. I was
basically, but when it's negative, you know, when it goes negative,
there
the
is
city
no loss
and it's
right.
Lose.
Yes.
Right.
But they're gonna the overage, you know, on the times that it's above 3%, is gonna more than make up for the.
And
if
say,
you can't make 3%, you have a much bigger problem.
Absolutely.
And I say no because the city's not contributing the 96% employer contribution, also in that equation.
Okay.
So if it's a negative year, I mean, they're already not having to contribute the 96%.
Right.
Because
they're in the drop.
Because they're in the drop.
Okay.
So
it's a slight win for them.
Yes. It's a win.
Yeah. It's
for the city. Not saying that it's not a win for the employees.
Yeah, but my point is there aren't that many
most of
people
us
right
would
now.
Never be able to leave without that nest,
yeah.
Right? Especially now that it's 1.3.
Right. It's way up there.
And what's happening is we see that once people hit 55, or the 25 years are leaving. Because the 1% is not...
Enough to entice them to stay.
Yeah.
It's like you, when you hit your, you know, you're not going
to
stay.
I'm so well, that I have
please.
To stay.
Right.
I mean, it hurts me to leave. It's not helping me to
right.
stay.
Like
but,
I said, they think
yeah.
it's a carrot, but I don't think it's really bringing much to the table.
You can't incentivize me with 1%.
I agree with you. I look at them already down the path, you know, unless it went up to something. It's all right. Bernie stepped up. I made a phone call.
I handed out
expenditure.
The expenditures. This board does not have to vote on them, but I did do it for the other two boards, and they have to vote on the expenses. But I thought instead of seeing quarterly, maybe. You know, it would be nice for you to see the expenses for the year. That, and I am in the process of preparing the budget for next year for the board. Now, it'll be submitted to council before we meet again, but generally it runs along the same amounts. The first sheet shows actually the adopted budget, what the expenditures actually were for the year and what the balance was, and you can see quite a bit of the general fund fell into the negative. General is very hard to predict who's leaving, who's staying. So we usually either are way over or way under, to be honest.
So we started at 135 million and ended at 120 million.
Yes. The reserve for fund balance, that is a balance that budget carries forward every year. Let's see. I think Rose shows that our actual year end was 117 million. Right in that area. So this one's always just a little bit higher. This is showing what the city will actually contribute to. On the next page, it shows the actual summary for each individual deduction expense. And then the last two sheets shows the actual month. Each month, what is billed, what comes in, what goes out, what we pay our employees, our retirees, sorry. The contributions that we get from the city monthly. What we pay some of our managers that don't, that we get invoiced on. Some of it comes out before we even, you know, some of them do it net in the book, and then some of them send us an invoice. The custodian, our travel expenses. We don't have too many line items. Attorney fees, foster and foster. So this was just a things that we pay out for the year.
So our custodial fees, how much do you think they're going to go up with us going to Wells Fargo? Just a guesstimation, give me a percentage. No idea, huh?
There's about $700. $800. I don't think. Most of yours are indexed, though.
Am I giving you a deal because the city switched the entire panel, the entire city over to Wells Fargo?
That I don't know. I just got the contract, so I haven't read it. But
they gave us a minimum of $10,000. For each general entity.
And you, the custodian fees in here aren't, that was one of the issues. They haven't been billing us for their services. I had to call them and tell them they hadn't been billing us.
Or lack thereof?
Yes. In April, we were billed for all of the prior year. April of 2015, we were billed for all of 2014. And then in June, I got one bill, and then I had to call this year in September and inquire about two quarters. So this doesn't really reflect what they actually charge us. But I believe it'll be along the same lines. I don't think it's going to cost us that much more, if anything.
All right.
We only have one manager that actually takes quite a bit, and that's the one I'll have to compare that one. Isn't it SBH or ATO? Is it ATO? Sorry.
No, not ATO. SBH, Wellington, and Wedge, are those all separate managed accounts? Those would be three. I think Wellington's commingled though, so you might just have Wedge and SBH.
Yes, Wedge and SBH are the only two that actually, and they do invoice me.
Yeah. The rest of them are all should be line items. They shouldn't really cost you anything on your custody.
So I'll have to wait and see what the trades are. Do a comparison.
Doesn't matter, you know, you're going to get some better reports, which is...
Yes, I believe we are going to, yes. Transfers are going to be easier. They actually, well, are...
Easy for me, I just signed something and it happens.
I know. They have forms that are available. When you send something in, they say, I've got it. When they do it, they say, they've done it.
That's wonderful.
That's amazing.
Right. That's you mean the way it's supposed to be?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well,
I literally went Friday afternoon.
Well, she finally got frustrated enough to bring it to my attention, and we're doing it now.
And Monday morning, I finally found out that Templeton's money was moved. I had to go in and run a report on both accounts to see if it moved. And it moved correctly. So.
And they CC me on everything as well.
Yep. They're recording, I just go in and pull the reports and
you know, X amount of information.
Yeah, well,
I did have to get Foster and Foster to help me when they did their conversion. Their reports were coming up February 9th. And nothing from February 1st to February 9th. The actuary actually helped get the report done from February 1st to February 9th. I mean, there was a lot of transactions that happened in that time.
And of course, they're not charging for that.
I'm sure they are. But it was all in their year end. They needed the statements as well as I did. So they go in and pull them right off of Bank of America, just like I do. So
I beat up on Doug a lot, too. Especially now they got this variable rate, you know, for him to do numbers, it's a lot. It's more convoluted as it could be, yeah.
It's 300 a calculation.
Well, and I understand. I mean, just because how skewed it is. I mean,
yeah, so look at how much money you're saving right there. Alicia can do the calculation.
We do the estimates. The board hasn't signed off on us doing the actual finals again. I mean, it's been years since they have, but that's at the leisure of the board.
Out of your estimates, I mean, the time I've been sitting here, I've only heard like two complaints that they weren't accurate. But have you heard any more?
No.
And I mean, we're talking, you know, normally a couple of dollars, but some people, you know, when they go into retirement, a couple of dollars is huge to them. I figure if it's that close, then maybe you shouldn't be retiring.
No, their new spreadsheets have gotten more accurate. And it allows us to do a pre and a post so that we can show people before 2013 and then after. It is a little cumbersome when we give them to employees. We have to sit down with them and explain it to them. But it is better, much better.
Mm-hmm. You know, in your education, if you do go forward with the education and trying to change it, you could show some estimates of the current compared to the Fed's 1.6. You know,
right.
It's going to cost you 3% of pay or whatever. Was it an increase of 3%?
Well, I was asking for employees to increase, yeah.
How much?
I think I was asking for 2. So where they're putting in 3, they were going to put in an extra 2, so they give up 5% of their pay.
So an extra 2%. But look at the difference with the payout difference.
Well, and I had a few that I talked to that, you know, it's like, hey, what does this questionnaire mean? And I explained it to them, and it's like their eyes opened up.
But have some examples, you know, right there on paper where they can say, yeah, it's going to cost you 2% more of pay, but in the end, this is the potential
payout. Yeah, the guaranteed multiplier for life is huge when you look at, you know, it's just some people, you know, it's, they don't want to give up what they have today for tomorrow, you know, it's,
right.
And that's the sad part. Minutes, did you get to read them? I know I just showed you some, but
I read them.
Did you read them electronically and you're okay with able to accept the minutes the way they are?
Oh, so moved. Second.
All those four?
Aye.
Okay. I guess we briefly discussed the risk overlay. I don't know, do we want to continue that conversation or I understand that the value of an insurance policy, but I don't know what it's going to cost us. It's huge.
Again, it depends upon when it's implemented. The price of options is predicated on where the market is and the anticipation of where it's going. When we had that conversation, the anticipation was that it was going south, and that was already priced into the options. It's a matter of timing, and I know we don't want to time, but I think certain things, you know, if the dollars are right, it might be worth timing. We don't have to go with it now. I defer to you. You know, we'll look at it the next time the market is astronomical. See if we can, implement it. But this product that they have, if we're going to revisit our investment allocations, if that's something that we would be doing now, in terms of the alternative investment sphere, or would we
look at that later.
Yeah, I think because we're going to go with Wellington, we're not going to really do that, but we definitely can down the road. I'll probably be doing another asset allocation for you early next year, and that we can look at it, we can look at it there.
And we've de-risked some anyway.
Yeah.
A lot.
Oh, yeah, we've been de-risking. If I could just back up, and I apologize for, you know, yo-yo going in and out of here. The thing with regard to the tax policy, there was no vote on it, and you would have needed me, I guess, if we would have had a vote on it, or what was...
Yeah, it's been on hold for, the board hadn't decided to do it or not.
My thoughts were when they went to the variable rate, we're commingling funds.
Right, right.
And we don't really know if this whole variable rate is a qualified tax approved.
Correct. Which is irrelevant as far as the city is concerned, because they're not...
It's huge to the employees.
But it's the employee, that would bear the brunt if the plan were disqualified from a tax standpoint. I think I remember during that conversation or conversations, I indicated, since there are only a few of these plans out there in the world, if we could maybe find out what kind of tax ramifications there were on those plans and how they dealt with them, to just kind of give us an inkling. So I don't know who was tasked with that chore. If that was something that we were maybe asking.
We asked Diane back then to look into it. I think Doug said there are no other agencies doing it in the state of Florida. We found one state up in the northern Midwest, I think it was, that was doing it.
I believe Palm Beach, they wanted to.
They were looking at it.
Can we perhaps?
They had the same two individuals as...
Of course, the Jim and Jim Show. They still exist.
Are they as active as they were, Lee? Jim?
Yeah.
Yes, they are. You know, they're not having a lot of success selling it to folks as they were a couple of years ago when...
Right.
You did it.
How many city managers got canned, I'm sure, as a result of their show?
There's only two that bid into it, us and one other one, so...
Very few did it. And those that did it, one or two I can think of, they have found that it's more expensive than it was supposed to be based on the presentation.
We're at 96.something%.
Can we maybe, and I don't know who would do this then, get a hold of whoever to find out what the tax ramifications were in these other plans, wherever they were, so that we can maybe see what that was?
Yeah, I think we may find that they didn't file for...
It would be nice. It would be nice to know.
Each one, I think, yeah.
If we were the only ones that said, there are some tax ramifications here. So, is that something we would do internally, Alicia? Or get Jim and Jim? Or are they off the payroll now?
They're on the city's payroll.
Yeah, I wouldn't suggest them for this purpose.
Yeah. If,
you wouldn't, in terms of they recommended this, what are the tax consequences, guys?
They were asked at a meeting here when we had the state
on the line. Was that conference call?
Yes. Yeah. We had the state of Florida, them, and then our group of people from the city, and then, Lee, I'm sure you were involved.
I don't remember being...
They didn't have anything in writing, but...
No, they hadn't at that time.
The state said that they didn't have an issue with it.
They don't think.
Actuaries didn't.
They don't think. Well,
they don't think.
Yeah.
On tax matters, the Division of Retirement stays out of it.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, they deferred everything to being federal. They don't want to get involved. You missed this. I was at the Brooklyn Zoo at the time when the conference call.
Yeah.
Has this been since I've been sitting on the board?
It might have been
It was probably just as you were coming about.
Okay.
And I just kept on questioning, you know, commingling the funds and, you know, if it's really an approved plan as far as the tax piece for the employees and the plan itself too. That I figure, you know, if it's not truly tax deferred, then there's a whole different set of tables you need to maintain in order to, you know, commingle funds, which would be a nightmare. And that's what I kept on climbing up about. It's, is it really legal as far as the tax deferred piece?
Yeah, yeah. I'd say that's extremely relevant.
Well, it was to me, and I mean, you know,
that's why. It still is.
That's why when they arranged for the call, I happened to be at the Brooklyn Zoo, and I just went off to the side, and we had a conversation.
So what was the end result of that?
That the state didn't want to get involved. It was a federal thing, and that's when I forced Diane to go get a calling out of a Miami attorney, tax attorney, and it was of their opinion. Sorry, nothing personal against lawyers, but, you know, it's all open to, you know, interpretation. And their interpretation was that it seemed like it should be legal.
Yeah, it wasn't very strong.
Yes, and I'm like, no, that's, you know, that's an innuendo. I want something.
Well, and that's where we had discussed Ice Miller,
right,
who we work with frequently. They're very well respected as tax advisors in the public sector. And I got the quote, which was not to exceed $6,000, and it was quote-unquote.
And so your point for bringing it up today was, are we going to move on? When I exited the room.
Right. So it's a $6,000 expense to the board.
Yeah.
I don't see it as a huge issue, but I think we need the closure if this variable rate plan is tax deferred for the employees and for the plan. I mean, it would be huge if it wasn't.
And not that I'm looking to shift things to the city, but the city obviously is the final payer. And the reason that we are having this discussion is because the city decided to change the plan. So I think the city needs to know. And if there's no look that the plan is going to be changed anytime soon back to something more definable.
I don't anticipate the city changing their direction with the plan. They see a huge expense to them when it went up to 96% of payroll going into the plan. All they can look at is, you know, that's huge when you look at it. I mean, payroll is expensive anyway, but when they look at, you know, 96% on top for the pension that they're obligated to, that's a huge expense that the Jim and Jim show showed a curve that it would go up, but they never predicted that high. They were really bad with their projection of the cost to the city, and the city shocked. And now, when so many people left and went to the defined contribution, the 401k plan, that's a whole lot less money now coming into the pension plan, which means that it's not going to be funded very easily for a long time to get rid of this unfunded, you know, liability piece. That's where I thought, well, maybe if the employees kicked in 3% to get a solid, rock-solid number instead of, you know, not to go below 1%, but it could always go up. And we've hit up to 1.3% out of the, let's see, it happened in 13, so, you know, it's a couple years now, it's never gone up. I mean, you can see what the returns are, you know. There's a real weird scale what they came up with, what it actually means, but it doesn't give the employees any ability to predict when they're ready to retire what that equates to. As I told them, the only thing they can be guaranteed is the 1%, not to go below 1%. So if you're going to run a number, run the 1%.
Which is like so many left playing.
Correct.
And why you have the union.
Correct. So it's like, you know, me beating my head against the wall, it feels good to stop. So that's why I said, you know, and I'm willing to approach it one more time, but, you know, it's just, it's painful because they all think the union's going to, you know, save them. And that's the sad part, you know?
I think we need to go get the opinion. My question is, since I think it's gotten better, but I think for some time there was this feeling that the pension board was inimical, if you will, to the city, that, you know, we were kind of representing the employees, I guess, whereas really we're representing the plan. I'm wondering if we were to go ahead with this tax opinion, if they would say, the city would say that it's the board's tax opinion, that they've gotten, and that perhaps we should get the city to buy into the fact that we're going to be doing this?
I think the city's already feel they've committed their obligation to prove to us that, as skewed of an opinion that we're getting, they invested some money, and I think they have closure. I just don't have closure.
If they,
I think that's the way it was written, to their opinion.
And who wrote this opinion? Was it a tax attorney? A pension?
Well, it was an attorney. It said that Diane contacted...
was it a federal matter?
It was a... Didn't
you say
it was
a tax attorney?
It was a tax attorney down in Miami.
In Miami area. But the letter wasn't very strong. I didn't
think. No. And I think it was like their opinion is that it's a legal plan.
We're talking multi-million dollars.
Right, and I don't think $6,000 is a huge amount to get this closure that we know that it's done. And let's move on. I mean, Randy, see you later. I'm asking the board to approve spending, you know, giving me the direction to spend the $6,000 so we can find out for sure that it's approved or not approved. Of course, it'd be huge if it's not approved, because, you know, then I'm going to go in front of city council about it. But
well, I'll make a motion that we proceed with getting the tax opinion whether the hybrid plan meets the requirements of the code.
Federal tax. I'll certainly second that. All those for it?
Aye.
Okay.
Yeah, a little late in the game, though, isn't it?
Well, it is, but I mean, I still have a huge concern that if it's not...
The board was left out of that whole process.
You know.
Yeah, before my time.
Before your time on the board, but the board was omitted from that entire process.
Council figured the quickest way to stop the bleeding was just to go to an outside consultant, right. and the ones that they got, they're some serious winners, but... They never came to the boards, and I went in front of council and said, you never came to the boards and asked us if we could cut back on the plan, if we could cut back on the benefits, if we could help save. They just took a new direction, and I mean, it cost them a lot of money for where they got to, and now they're horrified at what they're paying out, because it was never predicted just how high. 96% of payroll of those that are still in the plan, they're paying to compensate for what was a whole plan. So 200 and some people left, and now they're still kicking in money for these people who left.
Right.
The people who left aren't kicking in.
Well, they're in their own plan.
We'll get it.
But a lot of them have left, and they still had years in the old plan, and they still have to keep that solid. So I ask you real quick, even though they're not official here, just to go through real...
That'll be my last item.
Okay.
Before we get to that, Alicia, when this ordinance passes, the drop ordinance, could you send me a certified copy of all of the ordinances that are currently in effect? And I will send those to Mary Beth Raymond.
I did that back in September and then again in November.
Certified? Okay. Well,
so then all you need is this one then?
Okay. But yeah, I did send them.
Okay. Well,
hard copy and electronic.
Okay. If there's any problem, I'll let you know. Okay. Yes, sunshine for Connie and Anthony. I think the most important thing for the two of you to know and remember is that you should not communicate with another trustee about any pension matters except at a publicly noticed meeting such as we're having today, that minutes are being kept and subsequently approved. So you shouldn't have communications by any means, not email, telephonically, in person, among yourselves. Now, you can talk to third parties, talk to me, Rose.
Employees of the city.
But we cannot be, however, a conduit to another trustee. So that's very important, and Flood is pretty aggressive in.
And you can't have like a call with, like I can't be on the phone with you and the attorney at the same time, like you can't. So.
And you can't ask Lee to check with Bernie about the conduit.
So the simplest thing, if you have questions, you can defer them to Alicia, she'll give you the proper direction, but I know you're not official for another week and a half, but I figure while Lee was here, at least if he just, you heard it from him instead of us.
And if I say something to you, don't reply all.
Yeah, don't ever reply all.
Careful with the email, yeah. No reply all, right. And, yeah, and the reason that I advise just don't discuss pension matters is the statute provides that you cannot communicate with another trustee on matters that will be coming before the vote, toward the vote, or, and this is the catch, where that may come before the board. Well, who knows what may come before the board for a vote. So, and then the other thing is that with very few exceptions, everything, as you heard me say earlier in the meeting, that come before the board are public records.
That's all. I just, you know.
And don't, yeah, and just one other thing, too, which I see every now and then. Don't pass notes. If we're at a meeting like we are today, don't pass notes around because obviously the public doesn't know what's in the notes, and that's the whole idea, really. Do you ever have any questions? I hesitate to call. Because as I mentioned earlier, Cindy called me once a week or so ago. Arnie's the only one generally that calls me, and not that often.
Of course.
I'm a text for you right now.
And it truly is a public meeting, so if anybody wanted to show up, if somebody approaches you and wants to come to this meeting, it's anybody can
just
come.
So you know, the sad part is years ago, we used to have a lot of pensioners who came and asked for a raise, and it's like, we're not making enough money to give out raises, you know? And so there were a few that used to show up, and they don't show up anymore. It's
those few guys that used to, I think they've passed away.
You're satisfied I did my job properly?
Top one.
Good.
Didn't need me?
No.
You good?
I'm good.
Motion to adjourn? All right. I hope you all had a wonderful time. Always.